shall come. Our presenters from different organizations, and I'll introduce them as they make the presentation. But also to say to honorable members, just as a reminder, that we are in that process of engaging with the medium-term budget policy statement. And as it is a practice, we always try to solicit the views of the public in the form of organized institutions, organizations, and individuals. Today we are going to receive comments from a number of, today and tomorrow, a number of organizations that are going to talk to us about the medium-term policy statement. It is by no accident that we have chosen to give the first bite on this matter to our chief economist of the Industrial Development Corporation, Mr. Lumki Lemondi. I always find their views and the entry point very, very interesting. And I hope honorable members will find their presentation very provoking, thought-provoking, so that we can be able to shape up the medium-term policy statement in our report as a committee back to the National Assembly and the NCOP. I must say to our presenters, bear in mind that we are meeting two committees at the go here, the NCOP and ourselves. We are taking this presentation at the go. Also, to make sure that you don't get invited for two or three trips on a similar subject. We're trying to ensure that both the private sector, public sector, also get assisted in cost-saving exercise. Thank you very much. And thanks for coming, Mr. Lumki Lemondi. Over to you.
The Chairman, Mr. Thabo Mofumadi, honorable members of Parliament, thank you for inviting us to be here this morning. I'm going to first refer all of us to the Minister of Finance's budget policy statement read in this House almost 6 years ago. On page 14, and I quote him, the rand has appreciated by 6.6% against the US dollar since December 2009. And by 5.5% against the currencies of our major trading partners. Taking into account that South Africa has higher inflation than its trading partners, the real effective exchange rate, which reflects losses or gains in competitiveness, is now about 12% above its average level for the past decade. Emerging market currencies of other commodity producers, such as the Chilean peso, have experienced similar appreciation pressures, while the Brazilian real is even more overvalued. We believe that international cooperation is needed to achieve a more stable international financial environment, as proposed in the recent G20 communique. In keeping this framework, several adjustments to our financial and foreign exchange regulation arrangements are proposed, while recognizing that in some instances, measures may be strengthened or reversed as circumstances change. So the Minister of Finance announced some form of regulation, the package of which I think the members have seen. However, in the South African debate, there is also a lot of discussion, particularly around the new growth path and the use of exchange rate in terms of the new growth path. That remains the subject of speculation because I think our staff have been seeing that growth path. I'm not so sure that members have seen it. But there's a whole discussion taking place around a weakened exchange rate-driven growth path. Let's now look at the currency, how it behaves, just to get an understanding so that when these policies are presented to members and the public, that we've got a much more informed understanding in supporting the Minister of Finance and other ministers who are very concerned about the strength of the currency. Here in this graph, I've got on the blue line, I've got the nominal exchange rate from 1990 to about the end of October 2010. And secondly, on the red line shows the real effective exchange rate of the rand. The line, the blue line that cuts across, is the line that shows the average performance. As you can see, above that line, that straight line, is rand appreciation, and then below, it is depreciation. If you look at the real effective exchange rate, you will see that the biggest noise took place around 2001. It's almost 2002 in the figure there, where the rand depreciated quite extensively, the real effective exchange rate, the red line. And also in the crisis of 2007-2008, when the global financial market, 2008-2009, when the global financial market collapsed. So really, if you look at the real effective exchange rate, you are not seeing as much volatility as you see when you look at it nominally. And therefore, the debate should really look more seriously on the real effective exchange rate than looking at the nominal exchange rate. As you can see, the volatility is much lesser when you look at the real effective exchange rate than the nominal effective exchange rate. Here, I've tried to look at our major trading partners to see how the rand behaves. If you look, it's against the euro, the US dollar, the British pound, the Japanese yen. And then I've also tried to look at the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and also the Aussie dollar, because the Aussie dollar, the Aussie economy, and ours, they've got lots of similarities in terms of commodity endowment. So I've looked at those to see how the rand has behaved. As you can see, if you look at the bottom, at the bottom part, I've got appreciation negative in the next numbers, or depreciation is positive if you look at the numbers there over a period. Firstly, in the bottom, if I talk you to the bottom row, around just below the yellow on the appreciation and depreciation, you will see that between January 08 and October 08, if you look against, for example, the Chinese yuan, that the rand against the yuan has depreciated, as you can see, with about 7.5% between January and October 8. And against other currencies, except for the Aussie dollar and the Chinese yuan, the rand has appreciated, particularly against the British pound. If you look, we've appreciated by over 20% against the British pound between that period. However, if you now shorten the period, let's look at the period that the minister is talking to, between December 09 and October 10. That's the last row of my graph there. You can see there that, again, we've appreciated against the Japanese yen and the Aussie dollar. I mean, so we've appreciated against the Japanese yen and the Aussie dollar. The rest of the currency, we've depreciated. So what one gathers here is that it's not so much the rand strength that you were seeing in the economy. It's got to do a lot about those other currencies being weakened. And that being weakened because of the relative of the economy. We all know about the euro area. We all know about the euro the US market. We understand about Spain and Britain. So therefore, the weakening or the strengthening of the rand against these currencies reflects the economic and financial conditions of those countries. So let's not rush very, very far to conclude that the rand is strengthening so much, etc. All of it has to do with these currencies working very, very fast because their economies are in shambles. The reality, just to make the point very, very strong, that the whole excitement around the rand strength, which for us is really more the other currencies' weaknesses than the rand strength, is cemented when you look into our trade accounts. I've got here our trade account between 2003 and 2010. If you look on the green the green bars talk to our exports, and the red bars on my slide there talk to our imports. As you can see, you can actually fold this thing. You can actually put it like this. So it's really cement the bond that our trade account hasn't done very, very badly. So those who are arguing for weakening of the rand may not necessarily be talking to the realities on the trade side, because those economies are weaker anyway. And therefore, if they are weaker, the demand is very, very less. And therefore, the rate of the rand, if you look at our trade balance here, you can see that it's not that volatile as well. It's very, very close if you look at that blue line that indicates trade balance. That, you know, when we're doing very, very well, we're at a deficit on our trade account. Now, we're moving very, very close to a balanced trade account. So it's not so bad as we thought, or as what commentators and some of the political commentators have been talking about. If you look at the evolution of our trade balance with the rest of the world, what the point I'm making in the graph is that since the, despite the rand appreciation since January 2009, the value of our export of raw materials and terminal goods has recovered to an extent in the first semester of 2010, particularly due to the Asian demand, in this case the Chinese and Indian. But also, the value of imports has recovered in most categories, except for raw materials, in the first semester. As you can see, again, in those two graphs, they show our exports and our imports in the broad term. And you can see those graphs almost look alike. If you don't look at them quite in detail, you may think the same graph showing the same thing, which really, again, underscores the point I've mentioned, that let's not get too carried away. It's got nothing to do with the rand appreciating and being overvalued and et cetera. It's got to do with the weaknesses of the other currencies because of the realities in those economies. For many businesses, ours in business, you know, it's not so much about whether the rand is undervalued or whether the rand is overvalued. For many businesses, it's about the volatility. The more volatile the rand is, the tougher it is to make business decisions. Because you have to make a decision, and that decision is based on an assumption. So those assumptions, in many cases, take into account our inflation differential and against our trading partners. So if I have to make those decisions based on that, the higher or the bigger the volatility of my currency, the more I either look very good when the currency has depreciated very, very much for an exporter, or look very, very bad the other way. So therefore, it's quite critical for us to really reduce the volatility of the currency, or to have some measures of how we can reduce the volatility, because that's what makes business decisions very, very difficult. So in literature and the behavior currently, or in the present circumstances, is that a lot of countries are embarking on ways of intervening in foreign exchange markets. And as we've seen, the Brazilians have, in October 2009, imposed a 2% tax on foreign fixed income purchases. Really, what you do there is that you try and make sure that whenever people are coming in, the so-called hot money comes in, if it stays in for within a certain period, it doesn't get taxed. However, if it goes in and out, it gets taxed. And that tax is referred to as a Tobin tax from a renowned economist from the UK called James Tobin. He's the one who came up with this idea, and hence the name Tobin tax. Also, we know that on the 4th of October, because the instrument was very blunt, as you'd expect this instrument, the Brazilians decided to double it from 2% to 4%. As you can, and later again to 6%. So you can see that the Brazilians aren't getting the results that they want. Despite hiking this thing, this is not deterring any of the inflows that are coming to the Brazilian economy. Because, hey, the world has changed. This is a golden period for emerging markets. It can never be better. And hence, it calls for great minds, for great strategy, in terms of how to use this golden period where our economies can be much stronger, can be able to catch up very, very rapidly to be similar to those of the developed countries. Secondly, another country that has done something is Thailand. Also, Thailand imposed a 15% tax on these inflows, on interest payments and capital gains. South Korea has done the same. Indonesia, also more similarly, Taiwan, the Philippines. So it's very fashionable among major markets. And people, the Brazilian Minister of Finance in Lula's government, used to talk to the so-called current war. But really, the fact of the matter is that it's a bonus for us. We're having all this money coming to us. And what I'm going to be engaging the members towards the end is what to do, because I think it's very, very important. But before I get that, I need to show you that some governments have done something, as I'll share with you. And the result, unconvincing, because capital keeps on coming in anyway, despite all this. And my other friends who are pro these instruments are saying it's actually easy money because you're getting easy revenue as a South African, as a revenue collector. In our case, staff, through these instruments, we're getting some revenue if inflows continue. But that's not the argument. I think my argument, which I'm going to pose, is going to be forthcoming lately. So, what is good about this? About this intervention. The potential favorable implication of this intervention is that it raises the price of competitive support. So if we can the rent, of course, in normal conditions, we'll be more competitive. However, we all know, I showed you earlier our trade account, that the demand has come down than what it was before on my slide number 4. Because our trading partners, particularly in Europe, with the 2% of our trade, before the crisis went to Europe, they are not necessarily demanding that much because households are completely overburdened by debt. So therefore, it does impose that you weaken the currency because your volume, the export volumes are down. So you can weaken the currency. What you'll see is that my friends in the mining sector will report massive profits without necessarily increasing production. What we want increased production. So therefore, this instrument for competitiveness under these conditions is an extremely blunt instrument. Secondly, what we see is that under the current circumstances, because for some manufacturers, it's very easy for them to import than export. So we've seen a flood, particularly in the global textile sector, where some manufacturers have tended to import because it's cheaper to import because the rand is so good. So you don't have to produce locally. You can continue supplying your suppliers domestically, not through your own production in South Africa, but by importing from China, Bangladesh, etc., and supplying for Shini or Edcon Group to reduce jobs here. So it's quite good. So there's a positive argument on that one. However, this is the downside of it. So there's all these things that could be really good by introducing saving tax, but there are also downsides. The position concerns about the uncertainty about the particular impact of this. This we've seen in certain countries which has introduced them is that you may find yourself that the cost of intervention is very, very high. Of course, it's all dependent on the instrument. So in a country like ours, the Reserve Bank will have to be tested as to which instruments they choose. And if these instruments are blunt, as you've seen in Brazil, that doesn't just say it's extremely blunt. It's not carrying any of the inflows. So as to what instruments you use, you may end up spending a lot of money greasy trying to intervene in the exchange market. We remember members in 1999, under Governor Stahl, we used an instrument of leaning against the wind because we're targeting a particular range. And we remember the cost that South Africans have paid for it. So why incur costs when we've got other priorities in South Africa, got other challenges in South Africa? But I'm leaving all these pros and cons to you to ponder because I'm going to take you to what I think we should be doing. Other real potential concerns are that in our country, where there's a huge infrastructure deficiency, particularly on the energy side, on the logistics side, which is impacting negatively in terms of competitiveness, because we are a very high input cost country, not to mention the cost of labor. So given all these challenges, how does this country of ours then become competitive when in fact we've lowered the rent, and therefore by lowering the rent we've got high cost for import? You know, how to then invest in infrastructure? So therefore, this is a big concern for me, if you try and weaken the currency when you've got very weak infrastructure, as we do in South Africa at the moment. So my story really is a very interesting one, in the sense that there are pros and cons of intervening in foreign exchange markets. You have to decide when intervene what instrument to use, and that instrument, what impact is it going to have on potential investors? Are they going to take a view that South Africa now has gone berserk? It's, I must take money away from South Africa and go elsewhere? We don't know. And the cost thereof, what it does to the economy. So if you intervene, and then we've got a food crisis, which we think is going to come very, very soon, and then South Africans have to import food from other countries, what about the poor? Are the poor going to be able to afford, because the rent is weaker, and the food, the shortage of food, the food prices have spiked, and therefore now we're importing food at a very, very high price because the government strikes in the foreign currency. So those are issues that we need to think about. So really, any intervention cannot work alone. It's got to work as a package of other policies. In our case, we know what we need to do, and I think that's what the members should be focused upon. We know that we've got high levels of poverty, we've got high levels of unemployment, and we've got high levels of inequality. On all these three areas, we've seen that Brazil has done it. Brazil used to be number one in those in the tables. South Africa has overtaken it. So one of the worst countries in the world. And I don't think it's sustainable. And we know how Brazil has done it. Brazil has done it by, firstly, it's got a much more bigger economy than we do. They've got over 200 million people. We've got 50 million people. It's too big, it's a too small economy. No matter how much we can invest in infrastructure in this country, we're never going to attend this. It's a small economy. So therefore, let's think big. Let's do things bigger. Let's talk regional. Let's think regional. Because if we do that, if we improve our infrastructure, because the capability lies here. Whether we're talking about the construction sector, we've got some of the best companies from the Group 5, the Marine Roberts of this world, who are very good in building first world infrastructure. You think in Dubai and parts of the Middle East, where South Africans have built massive infrastructure. We saw it recently in the mining sector in Chile, how South Africans were involved in investing miners as a threat. So why don't we use these capabilities to strengthen the South African, Southern African regional infrastructure, secure our own interests in terms of making sure that our businesses that are funding to weather in Zambia, the reconstruction of Zimbabwe, reconstruction of DRC, to start creating this bigger market, which is not only going to make business sense for our businesses, but also will make sense for foreign direct investment, not the hot money that we're seeing that's going to this exchange. So, for me, that's the question that members must focus upon, is strengthening our economy for the rest of the continent and making sure that we use our companies to go into Zimbabwe, to go into Mozambique, because we've got strong capabilities, and deepen the manufacturing sector. A job created in Zimbabwe is a job, is one more job in South Africa, because basically Zimbabwe go back home. And therefore, if they go back home, the space for Africans to get their job. Similarly in the DRC, similar in Angola. So, members, let's not intervene in the rent. Let's go back and fix our problems. Our problems are infrastructure instead of the continent. Let's make sure that I can get to DRC by rail. If I'm to go to Kinshasa, I can go there by rail. Not only me, but the commodity producers that are busy mining in Kinshasa, copper and other commodities, are able to go in and get out. Let's link the water bed to one which build roads, Let's build the infrastructure of the river bank, because we are much more flooded in the Chesapeake Bay port. We're not able to meet the demand there. So let's move from the hinterland all the way to the west coast of South Africa. So let's focus on those ideas than busy transmitters, you know, the currency, wasting our taxpayers' money because we think we're smarter when there's a global shift. The global shift is that the economies, the developing economies, as we know them today, are never going to be the same. In as much as the developing economies will never be the same. But the local economies can get worse if people make wrong choices. If people start playing in areas which are not the core of their people's needs, they may make mistakes and miss this golden opportunity. So I'm calling on members to push very, very hard to use this window to import capital to make sure that we've got locomotives. That PRASA, our commuter rail company, can move our people at a much more affordable cost because the state invested in infrastructure and rolling stock to make it easier for business, make it easier for South Africans to move from point A to point B, whilst making sure that that infrastructure is spread in the rest of the continent, than busy talking about looking at the currency when we know what to be done with the economy. Thank you very much, members. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mondi. I think it is a very, very good presentation. If I were to allow members to engage with this presentation now, we may not have time to receive other presentations. So I'm going to request that we take the next presentation in terms of our program, that is Mr. David Ruth from Efficient Financial Holdings. And then we'll then take the discussions of both presentations immediately after he completes making his contributions to this committee. Thank you. David.
Mr. Chair, honorable members, thank you very much for the invite. This is really a highlight for me whenever I get the opportunity to talk to our political leaders. Thank you very much for that. My presentation will cover one of the things that my colleague, Mr. Mondi, has touched upon already, so I will just rush through that. Perhaps suffice to say that I broadly agree with my colleague, and I don't think that we should unnecessarily intervene with the currency, but I will try to put that into perspective as well. And of course, the important thing is that we have to touch on the budget. However, I think what is important also is to try to look at the budget, the medium-term budget of the Minister of Finance, and try to look at it through the new, let's call it again, median world in which we are currently living. Perhaps just a bit of a background. The world has just gone through what is called the Great Recession. What caused the whole thing? Now, depending on who you listen to, you will get excuses or reasons like, for example, insufficient regulation, which I don't believe is the reason for the world's economic woes, simply because we've never seen so much regulation, we've never seen so much laws and on banks and on just about everything. I mean, our good political leaders make sure that there are more than enough laws. Of course, the excuse of the reason called greed, I also don't believe that's the reason. Simply what happened is that a certain environment was created globally and that the banks, for instance, simply played along. Greed, in fact, is a good thing as long as you do it within a certain set of norms and rules in your country, because the opposite of greed is to be wasteful. Then, of course, a very other popular excuse is because of speculators. Recently, for instance, Angela Merkel of Germany banned the naked short sales because speculators were blamed for the then euro being under pressure. That's not the reason. Again, speculators are just a messenger. Don't blame speculators. The truth, actually, the reason why the world went through this, still going through this difficult patch, is because of interest rates that were too low. Monetary policy was just too accommodative. Interest rates, particularly in the United States, was too low. And when interest rates are low, people buy things. That's simple as that. They borrow money. House prices went up. Another very important reason is a lot of political interference. I just gave it a general name, called it political interference. Let me give you one example. Is that, for instance, in America again, is that they have institutions like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae that give loans to people that can't get loans anywhere else so they can buy houses. So they actually encourage people to take out loans. And the result of that was people borrowing a lot of money, buying houses, house prices going up, resulting in this bubble, and when the bubble eventually burst, it was it led to the Great Recession. I usually compare this to two parents. The one parent is buying the booze, and the other parent is encouraging the kids to drink. So whose fault is it? And I think quite often it is because of the wrong macroeconomic policy and mistakes that we have made. And the Americans, the Europeans, but to a much lesser extent South Africa as well. So what are the three major ways of addressing the current problem? Now, they are the three major or most important economic schools of thought, if you like. The classical school are the laissez-faire guys. They say, let's just leave everything will come right. And that is, of course, Adam Smith, the classical economist that really put everything on paper on what he thinks the classical economy should look like. The monetarist, of course, that's Milton Friedman. And essentially what he said, that is, if you increase the pool of money in the economy, you're not going to get more wealth, you're simply going to get more inflation. And your currency will eventually weaken. If you increase the money supply, then you're not going to make much progress in terms of economic growth necessarily. And then the middle one, and that is where we all are at the moment, the Keynesians. Now, essentially what's been happening in the world is that demand from the private sectors in the world collapsed. People are not buying stuff anymore because they have too much debt. So because there's not much demand from the private sector, the state or the authorities are trying to provide this demand through all sorts of means, and we'll get to that just now. And the theory behind this is that if the state spends a lot of money and buy a lot of stuff, they will keep the factories running, and eventually the private sector will come back and start buying again, and the economy will keep on growing. That is essentially the approach of the Keynesians. Whether that's going to work, that's of course another question. So those are the three most important economic schools of thought, and I think we can certainly call the world currently a Keynesian world. That's what we're doing at the moment. There's a huge amount of interference by especially the Americans and Europeans and many other countries in the world as well. This thing called fair quantitative easing, I just want to explain it in simple terms so that we all know what we're talking about. I've put two circles there. The one is the U.S. economy, the other one is the United States Federal Reserve or their central bank. So how do they do this thing called quantitative easing, and why is it impacted on the South African economy? Let me show you how it works. The Federal Reserve will go to the U.S. economy, will go to banks, for example, and they will buy things from the banks. They will buy bonds from the banks or mortgage financial instruments. They will buy things from their banks. I don't know what happened now. Sorry about that. So they will buy things from the banks in the United States, and they will give the banks dollars. They will give the dollars to the banks. The reason why they want to do this, because they want some economic activity to start taking place in the United States economy. So they are hoping for some economic activity. There is some economic activity because of this thing called quantitative easing. Unfortunately, what happens is wrong. The U.S. economy, the banks, they take some of this money and they give it back to the Federal Reserve. They say, listen, we don't want to do something with this money. Just keep the money on your balance sheet. But a lot of this money is also leaking out of the U.S. economy, and it goes to things like, for example, commodity prices going up, and it goes to places like, for example, emerging countries like South Africa, for instance. So this money that's being printed in the United States certainly does result in some economic activity, but a lot of that money leaks out of the system, and that money ends up in economies like, for example, the South African economy. So this is just some driving forces in the world that I've identified, and I think it's important. The Americans and the Europeans, to a slightly lesser extent, are simply printing dollars and euros. Now, if you increase the supply of tomatoes, what's going to happen? The price of tomatoes will eventually start falling. And I think what is going to happen, and we have already seen this. In fact, this specific slide I prepared in January this year, and a lot of this has come true already. The dollar and the euro will come under pressure, and they will probably stay under pressure. Perhaps just a comment I should make. The European economy, and particularly the United States economy, is not going to grow for the next 10 or 15 years. They're going to go 1-2%, perhaps 0, minus 1 sort of thing. There's very little economic growth that's going to come from the West. And the West, I include Japan. So if you increase the supply of dollars, the dollar will fall and other things will have to go up. And things that are likely to go up are things like, for example, the renminbi, the Chinese currency, commodity prices, and the rand as well. So that we are part of the global environment, and that is what's happening at the moment. All right, we're slightly closer to home. We've had a number of plans in South Africa, economic plans. There's just a list of some of these plans. We don't know the new growth plan, as my colleague has already mentioned, we don't know what it looks like. We've got an idea. We're going through the Minister of Finance's speech, for instance. So we don't know. But the, obviously, as always, the emphasis on this plan is probably going to be on things what it already is, on poverty, unemployment, and of course, economic growth. But what I've seen so far is really not that much real. A couple of targets in the growth plan. I'm just going to rush through this, but a continuation of relatively sound and conservative fiscal stance. That's what we've had in South Africa, and we're probably going to have for, hopefully going to have for quite some time. Current account deficit, which we had quite a large current account deficit, that was also a focus. Low interest rates, the cost of capital, we must make money cheap so people can invest more, but keep in mind always there's always the danger of eventual inflation, a competitive currency of Hassanet, and of course, unemployment. Now, I went through the medium-term budget and the new growth plan, which we don't really know that much about, and a couple of highlights. Labor market stuff, skills development, that's what we need to do. Development in for finance institutions, and my good friend here is one of those financial institutions. IPAC, improved competition, improved public services. We've heard all of this. We've heard this is nothing new. But it's one thing that stands out from media, and I think that is the most important one. And that's that one in the middle, down at the bottom, improved competitiveness. Essentially what this is saying, we must include the private sector because wealth creation only comes from the private sector. It does not come from the public sector, or very little coming from the public sector. And that is the only, if you go through all of the, essentially what I'm saying is that the state must do A, B, and C and all sort of things, but the real improvement to everybody in South Africa will only come from the private sector. The big thing, of course, is unemployment, and I've just prepared a little slide here on unemployment. We want companies to employ more people. Why don't they? A couple of things, just a few bullet points that I've put down there. Barriers to entry. Let me give you some barriers to entry. It's difficult. It's difficult to start a business in South Africa because of things like, and I just call it red tape. Because of our good friends in Parliament, for instance, we have many laws that we have to comply with. Now, there's some list of the laws, and I'm not saying we should get rid of those rules. Don't misunderstand me, but the point is, it's not always easy to do business because there's a lot of paper that you have to, paper and forms and things that you have to complete. FICA and FICE and RICA and NCR and all sorts of things. It's difficult. That's the reality. It's also difficult, all these different taxes. It's much easier than in the past, but it's difficult to comply with all these taxes. We must make it easy for business. I'm not necessarily saying they must pay their taxes, but it must be easier to pay taxes. Licenses. I want to start a cell phone company tomorrow morning. Can I do that? The answer is no, because I can't get a license. Can I open a radio station tomorrow morning? The answer is no, but I won't be able to get a license. That's not the reason. Access to capital. It's easier today. My friend already mentioned that there's a huge amount of capital coming into South Africa, but still it's a problem for companies, for business. Labor laws, I'm going to touch on that a little bit later. I would like to just mention some short example. I met a guy last year. He employs a lot of people. He only employs Zimbabweans. And I asked him why. Is it because minimum wages are not? He said no, exactly the same minimum wages. Is it because disciplinary procedures are different? He says no, exactly the same disciplinary. So why do you employ only Zimbabweans? He says because they are better workers. Now, I don't accept that. I don't accept it. And I couldn't get an answer why the government. And as I left, he made a comment about work visa. And he says, every, I think, 6 months, they have to reapply for a work visa. And he's got to sign this application form. And if he doesn't want this worker, he simply doesn't sign. That's the reality. The reality is, labor legislation that's there to protect South African workers are keeping South Africans out of jobs. That's the reality. That's why he only employs Zimbabweans. Taxes, I think taxes, I'll get to taxes just now. Foreign exchange controls, I'll touch on that a little bit later as well. And then property rights. Our property rights are very well protected in South Africa, but I have spoken to some international investors that are a bit concerned about certain comments made by some of our political leaders. All right. I'm not going to do very much in the currency. My good colleague here is starting to discover that sufficiently. Maybe I can just run through these couple of graphs. This is just the dollar, rand dollar exchange rate. I'm only going to compare the rand to the dollar, which is not 100% correct, because you have to compare the South African currency to a basket of currency, but I want to make a specific point. There are certain ways through which we can calculate the correct value of the currency. You can look, for example, that's just a crisis that we've had. You can look at purchasing power parity, a relative thing. That's the inflation differentials, and that's where the currency should have been if we start in 1979, for instance. The problem is if you start with another date, you get another answer. And if you start with another date, you get another answer. So I'm trying to find out what's the correct value of the currency. See, that doesn't help. There's another way through which we can do it, and it's the Big Mac Index. I'm sure you all know that. It's an absolute purchasing power parity approach. And I've looked at the IMF basket of consumer goods, and I've calculated the purchasing power, and the absolute purchasing power parity thing, and that's what it is. So the black line, the red, by the way, are my estimates. The black line is the actual, and the blue line is where the currency is supposed to be. This is theoretical stuff. It doesn't mean it's necessarily where it's supposed to be. It's just their theoretical approach. Actually, the rand should be trading at 5 to the US dollar. That's the point. It's not trading here, we know that, but on this theoretical basis. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the difference between the actual and where it should be trading, and you calculate that in a percentage thing, you get that thing. Now, but it tells me, the rand is not overvalued, it is undervalued, theoretically. There are other arguments which will certainly say that the rand is too strong. I grant it. I just want to make a point here. And this is exactly the same graph that my colleague here showed, just a little bit differently. The rand is currently undervalued, but it's much less undervalued than in the past. The last time the rand was more or less at this level was in 1980, where the gold price was at very high levels, and there's just a trend line there. So the rand is, historically speaking, very strong against the US dollar, but it's not as strong as it's ever been, firstly, and it's not necessarily overvalued. But historically speaking, the rand certainly is strong. What is really affecting the currency? Not the theoretical stuff I've just mentioned. The only thing that really matters is capital flows. If money comes in or not. And currently money is coming into the South African economy, and that's the reason why the rand is getting stronger. Really, it's basically and as simple as that. Okay, what can we do about that? We can buy reserves and sell rand. Let me explain to you how it works. There's the South African Reserve Bank and the South African economy. So the Reserve Bank then goes and buys dollars. But remember, the Reserve Bank buys dollars, they have to sell something else. They sell rand back into the system. Now we have too much rand in the system, and the Reserve Bank needs to drain those rands out of the system. What they do, they sell, say, CDs into the system, and they take the cash out of the system. All right? Unfortunately, that dollars that they bought initially, they can invest that at 2.5% in the United States, but they have to drain this liquidity at 8%. And the difference is the cost to the taxpayer. It's expensive. We're doing that, but it's expensive. We're doing that already. Something else we can do about the currency. We can lower interest rates. We have done that. But keep in mind, money is not coming to South Africa because of short-term interest rates. Money is coming to South Africa because of long-term interest rates, the capital market. And the Reserve Bank can't do that much about the capital market. So we are attractive, even if the Reserve Bank cuts interest rates around strengthen, because the money is not going to short-term money market instruments, the bulk of that going to the capital market over which the Reserve Bank can't do much. The Tobin tax, my good colleague explained that, and again, I agree with him. I don't think it's going to work, and I don't think we should be doing that. And the last possibility, of course, is the foreign exchange regulations, which the minister is going to relax quite significantly, and I'm very happy about that. If you have foreign exchange regulations in your country, it's a vote of no confidence in your own economic policies. So let's open it up. And that's what we're going to do. We've done a lot already. There's a clever trick. Our Minister of Finance is a clever guy, and there's a fifth option. And he's doing that. And I don't think people have picked that up yet. Let me explain it again through by way of a graph. Pretty much the same as the graph I showed just now. There's the Reserve Bank, there's the economy. Now what the Reserve Bank does, they buy dollars. Okay? And they sell rand back into the system. Now they want to drain this rand out of the system. Now what's a cheap way of taking money out of the system? And they will go, the Reserve Bank will go to our dear Minister of Finance and say, can I take some of your money as the tax and loan accounts in the system and take that out of the system? Because, first of all, we want to weaken the currency, but the Minister of Finance got a big problem. His revenue is doing better than originally expected. They've got all this extra cash. And we know if there's extra cash in the bank, somebody would want to spend it. So the Minister of Finance got a nice problem. He wants to get rid of his extra cash. And one valid way of getting rid of his cash is giving it to the Reserve Bank, taking your money out of the system. So it's a very clever move. So essentially what is happening is that monetary policy and fiscal policy is mixed a little bit, which is a bit of a downside, but it's a cheaper option, firstly. And secondly, the minister gets rid of extra cash, which of course is a good thing. In fact, the Reserve Bank already owes the Minister of Finance more than 135 billion rand. And the politicians don't know about it, which I'm really happy about, of course. Okay, I just want to go to taxes a little bit. And we've done some calculations here. You only have one on your slide. There's only one graph. There's a couple of graphs on top of each other. And just I'm just going to go through some of them. This, you know, we have different income categories in South Africa. And different people, different income categories paying certain amounts of taxes. I'm looking at personal income taxes at the moment. Now, at the right-hand side, that's the red line there. This is in 2005. This is how much taxes was paid by the low income categories, 0 to 150,000 rand income categories. In the middle, we have 150 to 400, and then the rich guys, the blue dot over there, that's how much taxes they pay. Remember, there are many people in the lower income categories and few people in the higher income categories. Who's contributing most to the fiscus? That's what I want to answer. This is 2005. This is 2006. You can see the lower income categories are paying less and the higher income categories are paying more. Move on a little bit. 2007. See how that shifted, how the tax burden shifted away from low income categories to the higher income categories. And this is 2008 and more of a shift taking place, and this is our estimates for 2010. The point I'm making here, we are taxing our rich. We are really milking them. And I accept that and I agree with that. And the tax burden shifted away from the poor. The problem is, we don't have that many rich people left in South Africa. The reality is that the tax burden shifted to such an extent to the, and I'm not talking about very rich people, I'm talking about the relatively rich people earning 400,000 plus, for instance, that we can't increase the tax burden on them anymore. Because of all sort of other things. They are the savers. If they pay too much tax, they can't save anymore. And that's happening. That's part of the reason why our savings levels in South Africa are very, very low. Okay, I'm going to touch on this just now again. I am sure that people are going to tell me, but the problem is that our Gini coefficient in South Africa is wrong. Essentially what it means, too few people earn too much. And that is in fact so. In South Africa, for instance, 90% of the people, or let me put it the other way around, 10% of South Africans earn 50% of what the economy produces. Which is quite skewed. That is indeed so, and we have to fix this. I'm going to give you a very nice way of fixing this. I'm going to skip that one. Now, this is a little bit technical. Please bear with me just for a moment. We have a pyramid in South Africa that looks like this. Rich guys on top and poor guys down to the bottom. But below the pyramid, there are a lot of people without jobs with zero income. Nothing. Okay? That's the reality of South Africa. Now, if we want to fix the Gini coefficient, we can do a few things. Now, the emphasis has been on taking money from the rich and give to the poor. And I'm not disagreeing with that. We're paying an economic price for that, but there's a certain political and social reality in South Africa, and we have to address this. I'm not against that. But it's my responsibility to warn against some of these potential implications for the South African economy. Let me give you a simple example of if we want to fix the Gini coefficient. Let's assume there are three people in the economy. They earn, each one earn a third of the income that is produced in that economy. Then you have straight line, that blue line. That's a one, rather a zero. Your Gini coefficient will be zero. Now let's assume, it changes a little bit. The one guy earns nothing, and the other two guys earn 50%, for instance. And that is the red line over there. And your Gini coefficient in this instance will be 34. Okay? So you've got a nothing and two 50%. The remaining two guys. Now let's assume we take the guy that earns, one guy that earns 50% of the income, and he shares that with the unemployed. What's going to happen, he will suddenly improve your Gini coefficient to 23. And that is the green line over there. We're getting much closer to that blue line. Let me explain to you why I say this is important. The emphasis has been, and it should be, on taking from the rich and giving to the poor. We don't have that many rich people left in South Africa. It will be significantly easier if we want to improve our Gini coefficient by sharing the bottom part of the pyramid with the unemployed in South Africa. Let me put it to you differently. If we allow the unemployed to become employed, and if we can reduce our, now I have to be careful, our labor input costs, for instance, in South Africa, that's a different way of saying that we should, in real terms, try to reduce our wages as well. I'm not saying reducing wages, but there's a ratio between how much we pay our workers and what they produce. If we can improve on that, and we can get the unemployed in jobs, our Gini coefficient will be improved dramatically. Don't look only at taking from the region, giving to the poor, making sure that the slightly lower end of the economy, I'm not talking about the very, very poor, but the slightly lower end of the economy becomes more competitive and more accessible to other people that don't have income. To share in that part of the pie as well, our Gini coefficient will be improved dramatically. We can't take more from the rich because we don't have enough rich people. That is just the point. And just to prove on this, I've made a calculation here on the budget. This is some of my estimates, and I've shared it with the honorable members already. Look at the bottom right, that's 6 cents, what it means. If you earn R1 million in South Africa, okay, you pay much more taxes than a guy that earns, say, R50,000 per year in South Africa, which is right, and which is, we should have that. It's correct, nothing wrong with that. But I've calculated, and it's easy to calculate it. Remember, the Minister of Finance takes mostly from the haves, and he gives mostly to the have-nots, which is right. But how much? That's the answer. If you pay R1 to the fiscus, to the Minister of Finance by way of taxes, and you earn R1 million per year, what do you get back? And the answer is about 6 cents. In fact, this is only national government. I'm excluding the provinces, and I'm excluding the local authorities. That person gets back less than 6 cents, actually, from every R1 he pays to the state. If for every R1 you pay to the state, look at that guy, the top guy, that's 47 rand, for every R1 you pay to the state, what do you get back if you earn less than 100,000? You get back more than 40 rand from the Minister of Finance by way of goods and services. So that's the redistribution of impact of the fiscus, which is right, of course. But we are overdoing it. And for instance, our savings levels are very low in South Africa because the rich are overtaxed. Let me put it differently. That guy that earns R1 million, if he should decide to emigrate, state will lose funding for 20 poor families. For education and health services and all. That's the reality. We have to look after our rich people. Now, the point I want to make with this slide, I think I'm running a little bit over my time, but the point I want to make is that we spend a huge amount of money on social expenditure, which is right. We can't spend more on social expenditure. We must spend better. We spend on education, for instance, and the outcome on our education is just not good enough. Fortunately for us, our debt levels, fortunately, the Minister of Finance and the previous Minister of Finance have been running the fiscal ship quite conservatively. And because of that, the state's debt levels are very low. And because the state's debt levels are very low, the state can afford it to stimulate the economy a little bit because we don't have the problems like what, for example, the Greeks have, or the Japanese for that matter, with their debt levels significantly higher. Unfortunately, what is happening in the current financial year and what's probably going to happen in the next couple of financial years, the state also destroys capital because the state borrows money. It's okay to borrow money as long as you spend it on capital. You can't borrow money and spend it on current expenditure because then you destroy capital. You are a dis-saver. Last year, on the current financial year, the state will destroy in excess of 100 billion rand. And I'm not against this, but this is unsustainable. That's the point I'm making. We have to do one of two things. Either we have to spend less on social expenditure, or we have to spend more on capital, preferably more on capital. So we can do this in the meantime for a year, two, three. Thereafter, we have to change this because the state keeps on destroying capital. For now, it's fine, but we have to change this. Essentially, but this illustrates the same point that we have to spend more on capital in the economy, and I think I'm running out. I just want to rush through my presentation if you don't mind. This is just some numbers. I'm going to touch on one or two numbers here. The first column is the budgeted estimates on some of the different taxes and state expenditure numbers and so on. The second column is my estimate on some of those numbers. The third one is the difference. I'm just going to touch on one or two here. The first one, PIT, personal income tax. The state will probably collect about 8 billion rand more than the original budgeted estimates. That's more or less in line with the minister's own numbers as well. But how is it possible that the state will collect more income tax when we've lost 1 million jobs? Why? And the answer is simple. Because 1 million jobs that we've lost is people that don't pay personal income tax, mostly. It just goes to show that the taxpayers on high income categories, and I don't mean very, very rich people. I'm actually talking about 300,000 or so. Maybe the third one, that value added tax, an overrun of about 8 billion or so that we expect. Main reason for that is because of FIFA World Cup. All right. I'm not going to go through all of this, of course, unless you want to touch on that. Maybe just one or two issues I would like to touch on, and that is the economic outlook for this year, which I agree with the minister, is probably going to be much better than we originally thought. I think the minister is still a little bit conservative. I think economic growth could quite easily exceed 3%. The economy is doing it really very well. I think my colleague also referred to that. That's why the foreigners want to invest here, because we're doing well. We're doing cool. Revenue and expenditure numbers are both better than budgeted. There are plans to spend more on capital. We have to spend significantly more on capital. Forex controls, the relaxation, we've spoken about it. And then the last one, the NHI. Now, I've just done a quick calculation on the NHI, just to put it in the picture, because we've got all these numbers flying around on the NHI, what that potentially going to cost. I looked at some similar countries like South Africa and how much they spend per capita on health services, for instance. And what I've done, I've calculated averages and so on. The bottom line is, if we spend another 50 billion rand on health services, we will be on par with most other countries in our income categories, if you like. These hundreds of billions that are thrown around, that is, this is going to be expensive. Remember, we spend a huge amount of money on social expenditure already. I'm just looking only from an NHI point of view. If we spend another 50 billion, but then we have to cut back on other social expenditure items, which is not going to be easy. Maybe from my side, I've listed a couple of taxes here which I would like to get rid of. Now, I will go through some of those taxes. I'm not the ticks, that's fine, the crosses are what I'm not really happy about. Secondary taxing companies, I know it will be replaced by a new tax now. Let's get rid of that. We must make it easier. We must make it attractive to do business with us. Let's get rid of that one. We were lost about 17 billion of the skills development levy. It's not working. The teachers are not working. It's another piece of paper that we have to complete. It's not working. Let's get rid of that. The nation's tax, get rid of that. Estate duties, security transfer taxes, transfer duties, that's mostly when you buy a property, for instance. Let's get rid of all of that. I'll keep that small tax for business. That's a good idea, because you try to make it easier for small businesses to do business. So they only pay a small business tax, which is good. We can actually expand on that. And then on the right-hand side, some other taxes we should get rid of. Airport taxes. Electricity levy. Maybe I can just mention something on this. The reason why the minister introduced an electricity levy is to increase the price of electricity so we can use less electricity. Rather get rid of that tax and increase electricity prices. You will achieve exactly the same, and there's less asthma. This is really as simple as that. The same goes, for instance, with the carbon tax that we just introduced. Rather increase the fuel levy. Why have another tax? It just complicates the whole system. At the bottom, I've got two proposals. We have to think a little bit out of the box here. Taxis, this is just one example. They don't pay tax, those guys, really. Why don't we introduce, for instance, a license? If you want to have a taxi, you have to buy a license, and this license is going to cost you 20 or 30,000 rand per year, and you don't pay any other taxes. Just make it easy for taxis, for example. Something else. We've got another of items in South Africa that's zero-rated for food, for VAT, for instance. No, it's wrong. We should have VAT on everything exactly the same, because then we're going to tax the rich as well. And I've just explained to you how the ratio works, where the money comes from, where the money goes to. If we reintroduce VAT on bread, for instance, the rich will be paying for the VAT, for bread, the poor will be paying, but all the money will be spent on the poor. The poor will gain. And it will make its system easier, for instance. Now, this is my last slide. Now, I've got a list of problems of interest. Our problems are, we've got huge levels of unemployment. We've got a poverty problem. There's collusion. They're all colluding. Greed. We must do more. There are too many cars on the road, for instance. That's not our problem. We don't have an unemployment problem. We have an employment problem. People are not employed. My Zimbabwe example is a good one. We don't have a poverty problem. We don't have enough rich people. That's the problem. We must get more rich people. We don't have a collusion problem in South Africa. We don't have enough competition. That's the problem. Greed is not a problem. I've spoken about it. Of course, when I listen to our good political leaders, we have to do more. No. We have to do better, not more. There are too many cars for the road. No. There are too few roads for the cars. That's the problem. And how do we fix this? And there is only one answer. We must grow the South African economy. We can't fix all these problems without economic growth. And whenever there's a law, whenever we change policy, economic growth must be priority number one. Because without economic growth, we will not be able to address all those problems. Only economic growth can address unemployment and will lead to a better redistribution of income in South Africa, creating wealth and fixing all our problems in terms of poverty and the like. Economic growth must always be priority number one. I thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tavi. Honorable members, we are 15 minutes behind schedule, but it is worth giving the presenters more time because they are here and they took time to prepare their presentation to us. This is an opportunity for us to engage, honorable members. Edwin, honorable Edwin Chani, you'll be followed by Honorable Des Van Rooyen, Honorable Gordon Wolf, Honorable George, Dion George, in that order. Not going to repeat again. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My first question to Mr. Mondi. I would like to know, in your view, other than the issues relating to the strength or weakness of the rand, what are the areas in the current policy of government on budget that needs to be given attention or be attended to in terms of changes that would require in this whole process of economic growth? Then question to Mr. Root, just a pity, Mr. Root raised a number of things that one would want to engage on, but maybe that will be reserved for another time. But I want to understand, in terms of this problem that you said that causes, that makes it difficult for business people to establish business in this country, which I don't agree with. I don't see anything difficult in this country for one to establish. Is it a problem of admin burden that arises as a result of the laws of this country, or is it a problem of the laws that seeks to regulate the relationship between employers and employees? And if that is the problem, what is the view of the business people? Are they saying we should deregulate? There should not be laws that regulate the relationship and that set certain standards and clarify the rights of those particular, the employer and employees. Because in my view, the reason why they are employing foreigners is because the relationship is dictated by the employer in that relationship. You either take it or leave it. But let's assume that the situation is that there are no laws and then everybody come and invest here. How will that impact on the issues of inequalities? Because currently, we have some of these inequalities because of some of the previous regime laws. For an example, the planning, to amplify that particular question. As a result of the planning, if I'm employed, let's take the casuals, employed in company A, getting 150 per week, but that particular employee having to travel from the township to town, spending 10 rand or 20 rand every day. At the end of the week, when he gets that particular 150, the employee is left with 10 rand. That is putting that particular employee into more poverty than when he or she was not employed. You see, you guys are not talking to those particular issues, real issues. Now, the last question. On tax, you seem to be worried that rich people are being milked. And you are suggesting that certain taxes should be done away with. On all the list of taxes that you say they should be done away with,
I will be interested if you can put the face of the beneficiary if we remove that particular, those particular tests. You will find that it is the same rich people that we are saying they are being milked who will be the beneficiaries. Because all this big infrastructure and everything, even the beneficiaries as we speak are the people who are able to afford driving in those highways, going to this area that we are talking about, to facilitate and make sure that things are easy for business to be able to create jobs. But despite those, they still not create jobs. Only government is the biggest employer in both public and private in this particular country. And government, there's no complaints about this thing that private people are talking about. That's why I need you to expand a little bit on those. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is to the IGC. Maybe I must start firstly by welcoming the two presentations. Mr. Mondi, in your presentation, at some stage, you know, I hooded that you were too biased to issues of regional infrastructure development at the expense of other initiatives that must go as a package. But this all concern was obviously addressed by a bullet point in your concluding remarks, that's the last bullet point, which I acknowledge that capital control measures will not be adopted in isolation. That simply says, I mean, the issue of regional infrastructure development must be treated as part of the package. But now, my only concern, which is a question, is if ever there was any thorough analysis done, I mean, to come to such a conclusion. Obviously, looking into aspects of what might be, in my take, impediment, you know, like the implementation mechanism of this particular approach, but also the funding there. I mean, how do we envisage addressing this? Some of the challenges that we might pick up, I mean, taking this particular approach. And to the last presenter, Mr. Roth, you said a lot about the red tape issues. And I think on your resolutions, your focus was mainly on tax issues. And we are not hearing this for the first time. But I think it's high time that we get to know specific or concrete proposals on how to ease the red tape. And so what are the best practices? I mean, I don't want to be tempted to think that you are advancing an argument that it's trying to encourage lawlessness, where we say, let's do away with these laws so it can be free for all. But let's get to know, what are the best practices? I mean, where do we think we need to ease by the red tape? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a question to Mr. Mondi. I would like to know what is his assessment, whether our economy will handle, how will our economy handle a sudden free fall of the rand? And is it not better to have a strong currency like we're having now than a volatile weak rand? And then to Davie Ruet, and also to both, I think it was very good to listen to both of the presenters. Firstly, in your first slide or third slide, you said what went wrong, and your second one was greed, and you said a good thing, but within the set of norms in a country. Now, I would like to know whether you don't think that CEO salaries are out of control in this country, and if you look at specific share options, not being utilized for workers, but only for one layer of executive, and the reason they normally give is you must keep them there. If you don't keep them there, they will go somewhere else. That's a fallacy after this recession. People don't move so easily into new positions, you know, from South Africa or whatever. My point is that share options have been taken and the next day they've sold it. So that is also a little bit of a not good. And then on the South African Reserve Bank owing the Treasury $135 billion. Is that not compromising the independence of the Reserve Bank? And then lastly, I see uh, you you say we must get rid of custom duties. 21 billion, I think that's what we have budgeted for. Now, the unfortunate part of that is that the majority of those duties go to Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. And if we take that out, we will destroy those economies instantly.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Mondi, you mentioned the difficulties that we're having with volatile and appreciating currency. The point about capital inflows is that we would be wanting to attract long-term capital investment in the productive side of our economy. So my question to you is, what should we be doing in South Africa to make the environment more attractive to attracting and retaining long-term investment capital? Specifically, what fiscal policy interventions can work to achieve this? Mr. Root, very interesting presentation. On page number 12, you gave us a Zimbabwe example. I didn't think it was a good example at all. I thought it was an example of exploitation, if anything. I think very importantly is that trade unions have a very important role to play in our economy in balancing the relationship between employers and employees, and as does labor law. But I do agree with you that our labor law is not as friendly as it can be and that it should actually be looked at. But as I said, I think that is quite a poor example, and it is an example of exploitation. You mentioned lower wages to get more people into jobs. I agree that too few people are employed. But what else should government be doing to resolve this problem? You said less government, but what, if anything, should they be doing? And you mentioned low borrowing. Do you think we should borrow more to stimulate employment in terms of a fiscal policy intervention? And then finally, on the issue of the zero rating on VAT, we know that VAT is a regressive tax. We know that proportionately poorer people pay more for the same item. So yes, you are saying that a rich person would also be paying for bread, for example. But wealthy people, many of them do not buy the bread that is zero rated. So that doesn't seem like a very sound argument to me. In fact, if you were to stretch the paradigm just a little, you would suggest that the VAT system as a regressive tax might be the one that you would want to be looking at if you're going to be slashing some taxes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I don't know who starts, but between
you,
the two of you have got 10 minutes.
Thank you, sir. I'll try to rush. Thank you very much for the questions. We can debate this, I guess, for a long time. I am not suggesting that there shouldn't be laws to regulate the relationship between employees and employees. Most definitely not. But what I am saying is that, and perhaps I can just sum to the question I got at the bottom, what is worse than getting exploited? And let's be realistic about things. We have probably close to about 40% in South Africa, unemployment level close to 40%. The only thing worse than getting exploited is not getting exploited. That is the reality. That is the reality in South Africa. We must do something to grow the economy to get more people in jobs. Now, if you call it emotional loaded words, sir, with all respect, sir, like exploitation or greed, we must think with the problems that we have with our heads and not with our hearts. We must grow the economy and whatever it takes. Let me give you an example, sir, maybe the first question that you mentioned about transport. The guy spends everything on transport. What is the real problem here? The problem is because he hasn't got a cheap train to come from his house to his job, for instance, infrastructural investment. That's how we're going to fix that problem that you mentioned about the relationship. And of course, it's got to be regulated. But the reality is that we've got few people that employ other people, and we've got many people that want to be employed. Where is the scarcity here? Taxes. My list of taxes here. Sir, I've opened this. There's a second tax there. It's called company taxes. Who pays that? If I may ask you, sir. Who pays company taxes? Not companies, sir. Companies don't pay that. Companies don't pay tax in South Africa. Or anywhere else in the world, for that matter. Because companies always, always shift taxes down to you and to me. And you and I, sir, are the only taxpayers in this economy. Companies will, if you increase the tax in a company, they will increase the prices of the goods and services, or they will reduce their wages to their workers, or they will reduce their dividend payments to their shareholders. And in the end, it's only you and I that pay all the taxes. Sir. It's not companies paying all these taxes. I'm not suggesting, and of course there are some taxes that lies a little bit heavier on the rich than on the poor. And I'm saying, why don't they make it easier and instead of estate duties, scrap estate duties and make the personal income tax a little bit more progressive, for instance. It will just be easier. The point I'm trying to make here is make the system easier. Don't try change necessarily who pays what taxes. I think that's the important point I'm trying to make here. An example, sir, on the red tape. We have recently, like a year or so ago, there was a new law by our honorable political leaders where if you want to buy a cell phone and SIM card, you must take your ID book and you have to stand in a queue. And I'm a little bit busy during the day, I can promise you. I have to go personally, take an account or whatever to have this whole thing done. It took me a couple of hours. Because cell phones lead to all sort of, I don't know why this law was introduced. This is an example of red tape. Did anybody ever ask how many, was there any change from before the law to after the law? For the reason that this specific law was introduced. I don't think anybody did any research on this. Was it worthwhile to have a law like this? I'm not sure there's an answer to that. And I can give you many examples like this. The greed and the salaries of CEOs, sir. I think, sir, they are, the first simple answer to this is that they work for themselves and the shareholders decide what they are paid. But I think there's a more important answer to why CEOs are paid huge amounts of money. And that is that there are not enough of them. We should have more CEOs. Let them get paid massive amounts of money, I don't care. But let's create an environment where anybody can become a CEO. And in the process, the salaries will start coming down. I'm absolutely convinced. But I hear what you say, sir. Just by the way, I've calculated how much taxes those CEOs pay. They pay massive amounts of taxes. And there's a scarcity of skills. That's the reality in South Africa. We have to do something about that. There are few people that can run listed companies. For instance, I must admit that some of the salaries that some of these guys are getting are really. But the reality is, and again, let's not be emotional about things. We must have more of these guys, more CEOs, more companies, and of course we have to do something about skills in South Africa. The 135 billion rand of the Reserve Bank, I can't remember the question. Oh, the mixed. Yes. I think it's an excellent idea, the Reserve Bank draining liquidity by taking taxes away because it's cheaper. The problem is, you can't see the cost of monetary policy and you can't see the cost of fiscal policy because you mix the two. So from an economic point of view is that there's cost involved in running or maintaining a certain monetary or fiscal policy, and we can in a way calculate this, but you're mixing the two. You're absolutely correct. About the independence of the central bank, it hasn't, as far as I'm concerned, really compromised the independence of the Reserve Bank so far, but I must say that potentially it can. I don't think it has yet. The customs duties are, of course, this is a wish list, sir. And of course, I've done the calculations. Lesotho won't exist if it doesn't mean for South Africa giving them nearly 90% of their budget comes from you and me. The same goes for Botswana, on a per capita GDP basis, is richer than South Africa, yet we pay the money. And for some examples. That is true. This is just a wish list. What I'm trying to achieve here is to make the whole system easier. But you're absolutely right, sir, on that. Exploitation in Zimbabwe. Yes, sir, you really nailed me. I think I touched a little bit on that. The reality is that we have to grow the economy, get more people in. But whether we like it or not, that's perhaps an example of exploitation. But just imagine if we can exploit everybody to the same extent in South Africa, especially the 40% without jobs. Just imagine if we can do that. We will fix many, many problems in South Africa. But perhaps it's a comment about wages. We just had increases, I think it was 7.5% to civil servants in South Africa. We are overpaying our civil servants in South Africa. They are not very productive. And we pay them too much money. And they're not always that good at what they're doing. And I can prove this in all sorts of ways. And I'm afraid that labor in South Africa is quite militant. And they quite often, I think, misuse their their very strong political positions to pay far too much. Whether the state should borrow more, I don't think so, sir, but I do think that if we do borrow, we must spend some capital. There must be a balance between capital spending and the amount of borrowing. We are borrowing. I'm quite happy with the borrowing plans for the next couple of years. Just keep in mind, if we keep on doing this, the state debt relative to GDP levels will increase probably to unsustainable levels, but we've got a couple of years of that. So unfortunately, we've been running a fairly conservative ship in the past, so very good on that. And then the last comment about that. Yes, it is a regressive tax. Absolutely, I don't disagree. But I think, sir, by going through some of my numbers that I've shared with you here today, is that the reality is South Africa's tax system is dramatically progressive. It's true. That in itself is regressive, absolutely. But I've done a calculation. If we want to get more money, for whatever reason, we're not going to get it on personal income tax. Because we can't reduce the tax on the lower end anymore, because that's where most of the taxpayers are. And we can't increase it on the top end because there are just not enough people. So even if you increase the marginal rate on individuals, you're not going to get more money. We can't increase the taxes on companies because company taxes are relatively high. We need to be competitive on companies. And the third one, the only other alternative, if we want to get more money for whatever reason, must be on that because there's no other alternative. The other taxes are just too small. The three major taxes are, of course, the three big ones, VAT and companies and personal income taxes. Companies and personal income taxes
Thank
are
you.
Simply not available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, sir.
Thank you, Bailey.
I'll be quick. Very quick. The first question on the areas of government currently on what can be done about economic growth. There's very easy stuff that government can be doing. Firstly, let's make decisions as to who's going to be Transnet, because Transnet has a huge responsibility on logistics, because that's the key to the monopoly. So if we're going to exploit our natural resources and structure, we need efficient trains to move commodities outside the country and domestically. However, we all know that South Africa should not necessarily depend on export. We need also to create demand domestically. So there also should be a focus on creating local demand. And that focus revolves around making sure that it's easy for capital to access, it's easy for businesses to access capital. That's where the IDCs become very, very important, as well as the Reserve Bank, in terms of making sure that where we are within the band, we lower interest rate further. So there's still the space at the moment for us to cut the business meeting by being 1,500 basis points. And I think the Reserve Bank should be able to do that. So there's space at the moment without even doing anything funny or riskier that we can get things done. And the second issue around regional development. We're a very small economy. Tavio shared with us that, you know, there's very few people that are wealthy in this economy. We know that as a region, there are areas where South Africa is extremely uncompetitive. For example, on cotton, Zimbabwe produces can give us better yields around cotton, and South Africa can beneficiate. We don't need this controversial point. It's much more efficient to create a downstream petroleum industry at source. Within the region, we've got two areas that can be very good at that. Firstly, on the West Coast, why don't we build a refinery in Angola? Build a big refinery that will supply the Southern African region fuel. Because there's a source. They've got the reserve. And the DRC is not very far. We can barge some of the oil from DRC, barge straight to the Congo River in a barge into the Southern Africa's biggest refinery in Angola. So on the west, you've got the petroleum and downstream site, where from the petroleum, then you develop a chemical sector, your paint industry, your polyethylene industry, etc., and your plastic industry. On the eastern side, you've got gas. We all know that we cannot depend on it. It's getting very expensive. Mozambique is well and down on gas. So what you need to invest is an infrastructure to pipe some of the gas, particularly to the nearer areas of Gauteng and Durban. We can do that. And then for this province here, from the Kudu Reserve here, we put infrastructure we make sure Cape Town is a success, to warm and heat our country. So there's basic stuff that really is doable. It just needs you, as well as other economies, to really make a decision about the region. Our economies are too small to succeed. And therefore, the regional approach. We've got the plan, we've got the studies, we're sharing this with the government, but we need politicians to push and drive a regional agenda, because a regional agenda will be good for everyone. And the last point, Chair, because I'm not taking the time, on the assessment about, on the impact of the Mr. Koronov's question around the free fall. We've seen the free fall that it did in 2001. We saw it. It had massive impact on food prices. Some of you were in the House will remember that we did an investigation around the causes of high food prices. Because suddenly, if there's a drought and the currency has gone to the dogs, food becomes very expensive, particularly for the poor. And we embarked on that. And I'm very pleased that the Competition Commission learned from the study that was done then. And we saw last week that Pioneer paid a hefty price for some of the behavior that impacted. So, you know, we are not on the right track in terms of dealing with some of these issues. And therefore, there is a thing that needs to be done. The other thing is a long-term vision, making decisions, and this country can be very successful as a region itself and as part of a regional economy, which is dynamic, similar to Brazil, and can belong to the Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which the South African government so ambitious to belong to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mondi and Mr. Ruot. You know, just listening to your presentations and the questions that have come from honorable members, and probably this is how one is going to feel throughout today and tomorrow, that perhaps we should have a way that we interact with you, not only when there's an activity in Parliament, like the medium-term budget policy statement or the budget presentation in February, because it is so, so enriching, not only for us, but also from your side, as we begin to analyze what you're saying and our views in that respect. And I'm sure as the committees of finance, we'll have to find a way to look into this particular matter. Time is never sufficient, but I think we should try to find a way to really appreciate your work by giving enough time and also to tease your thoughts. I mean, listening to you, Mondi, on the currency issue, it's almost a direct contrast of what the minister said. Your minister. Now, I'm just saying it is very, very interesting, because when we meet with our colleagues from that side, the debate will be a different way, a different one. So it means it's true that if you were to lock two or three economists in a room, the likelihood of getting a seven economic models out of the particular problem, it is a possibility. But nonetheless, I think this current analysis does present us, and what I like is the fact that the emerging economies have got a better position to begin to strengthen their position in the current global environment. We can never have a better opportunity than this one, but I think we'll need more time to actually tease these issues. The next presentation is going to be by Busa, and I'll probably allow members to stretch their legs for 5 minutes once they are beginning to set up their things. And once again, David and Lumkile, thank you very much. The information is with us. I think in a way we'll come back to you individually and collectively to continue to explore the ideas that you have given to the committees. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief.
Very interesting.
Yeah. As I've already said, we have to take the next presentation from Business Unity South Africa by, I think it will be led by Dr. Pazin, who has been around this committee room. The next presentation after after Busa is going to be People's Budget Coalition. I guess they are here. Oh, they are around. Okay. Thank you. Just be ready so that immediately after this presentation we move to your presentation and have discussions. We change in time. I mean time.
Yeah.
We started a bit late, but also the previous presentation took a little bit longer. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to
allow Business Unity South Africa to make a presentation to you. Let me just introduce our delegation. Simi Salisa is the Economic Director at BUSA, and Kunrav Besaidnout heads up our parliamentary office in Cape Town. Chair, I think the challenge we faced when we applied our minds to what we wanted to say today was very much along the lines of, given where we are in the sequence of presentations, in what way could we add value to what you have already heard? I'm reminded to some extent of the remark made by a famous film star, I think it was Elizabeth Taylor, who on her seventh marriage, she said, "I know what I have to do, but I don't know how to make it interesting." And I think the point here is really whether we can add something over and above the excellent presentations that you've already had. So I think what we're going to content ourselves with doing is just to give you some business perspectives on some of the factors and the variables that have been raised on a very selective basis, and perhaps also to leave a little more time for the question and answer session, which will also, I think, add value for us and for the members of the committee. So I think you have received a written submission. I'm not going to read it. I'm going to speak to certain points which arise out of it and identify them as some of the business perspectives on certain of the key variables which you've been discussing up until now. And these issues, of course, have risen from discussions within business, within BUSA, within its standing committees, especially in the field of economic policy, as to how we address some of these issues. And we divide our perspectives perhaps into two main sections. The first will be the short-term economic outlook, and then implicit in the mini-budget is our agenda for a higher, more inclusive, job-rich growth path in the future. So, Jay, I would then like to just perhaps present the following 7 or 8 points which arise out of this approach. The first is, if we look at the short-term economic outlook, which was reflected and commented upon in the policy statement, certainly the BUSA reading of the tea leaves is that the economic recovery this year is still very vulnerable, and that the pace of economic recovery, when you talk to many sectors of business, is slow. Now, this is not only because of the uncertainty in the global economy, but also, as you've heard from earlier presentations, and indeed in the minister's speech itself, that the trends in consumption and indeed investment in our economy are still very modest. Now, 1 or 2 decimal points between friends are not important, but we still, when we talk to business people, to the extent that they articulate this, they certainly wonder whether we will reach that magical 3% this year or not. Let's put it this way, for the time that's left in this year, we better work hard at it, because we may be lucky to reach 3%. The second point that really flows from that when we read the budget speech is the role of reinforcing infrastructure growth. Because of the need, Chair, to reduce the bottlenecks in our economy and to support private sector investment, the role of the total infrastructural spending of 811 billion rand, which has been projected in the budget speech, is particularly significant, and it is important that it happens, that it is translated into tangible projects and programs. We welcome the prioritization of energy, transport, and water supply in this sphere, but it is important to ensure that these projects are embedded in the plans for our infrastructural spending, that they are implemented, and if necessary, make greater use of public-private sector partnerships in order to ensure that they happen. The next point is the balance between fiscal consolidation on the one hand and being growth friendly on the other, for which you've also heard something in some of the earlier presentations. We think that broadly speaking, Bruce sees the so-called mini budget has struck the right balance between fiscal consolidation, which is spread over a few years on the one hand, and the immediate fiscal steps to underpin, in fact, renewed growth and employment on the other. We think the broad balance is right, but it's a delicate balance, and we must have the confidence that we will be, as far as it is practically possible, stick to that fiscal plan over the next few years. The fourth point I'd like to mention as part of our perspective in our discussion, and if you read the budget speech carefully, you'll see it does raise the issue of effective institutions as an absolutely critical element in underpinning the much-desired turnaround and growth that we want to see. State institutions obviously feature very strongly in this regard. We in Brusa have also identified this as a major factor in a number of fora, and we've certainly, just to pick up a point that was raised earlier, we do need to see the far wider use of the regulatory impact assessment mechanism in various government departments. It is started, but quite a lot of the problems, the unintended consequences that come from what are perceived to be excessive regulation could be avoided in future if we could implement that system and evaluate laws and legislation in advance for their impact and what will be their benefits in relation to their cost. And we think that this will be an important part of what we will need to do in order to get onto the higher job-rich growth path that we are now seeking. The fifth point we'd like to raise, I suppose it's an unavoidable point, Chair, is the issue of the exchange rate. I think we think the government is keeping a cool head about the exchange rate, and that the budget speech has devised some sensible and structural responses towards a more stable and a competitive rand. We think what's important here is that the steps that have been announced in the budget speech in regard to the rand, we welcome them as capitalizing on the currency market to strengthen our financial markets in the long term, such as further exchange control, liberalization, the forex, where we build the reserves, and the further development of a sound prudential framework. Once again, with all the caveats that have been made, there is a limit to what a small open economy can do in order to stabilize its currency under present circumstances. But we support whatever practical measures can be taken in that regard, with full recognition of their limitations. The next point is, I think, in regard to that, Chair, the role of the current G20 meeting in Korea is really quite important. And we support the view that was outlined by the minister then in his speech that we need to achieve a more stable international financial environment, and we have to work together with other countries to indeed ensure that. And while we mustn't have any sort of strong expectations as to what might come out of Seoul, we certainly think that the exchange rate tensions do need to be managed far better than they have done up until now. So that's certainly something that we support, and we support the fact that South Africa is committed to trying to secure global cooperation in this regard. The next point, Chair, we'd like to emphasize is finding the right balance in our future policies. And here, I think we must see, we certainly in our discussions in Brusa have seen this particular budget speech as another stepping stone towards the recognition that we do want to get onto our higher growth path, we do want to create more jobs at any given growth rate, and that actually we need to make some important and rather tough choices in the near future if we want to get onto that higher growth path. You will recall that in the budget speech itself, on present trends, the forecast is that by 2013 we might just manage a 4% growth rate. Well, certainly in our view as BUSA, that may be a realistic assessment, but we should not accept it at its face value. We actually need to do a lot better over that period. And indeed, the whole issue of the balance between our infrastructural investment, which is now so essential to indeed reduce the costs of doing business in South Africa, to ensure that we are more competitive in the years ahead on the one hand, and the welfare payments on the other, to which also earlier reference was made, we certainly think that is a balance that has to be kept if we are to ensure a much higher growth path and a job-rich growth path in the years ahead. That brings me perhaps to my final point, because, Chair, as I said at the outset, rather than offer you a technical presentation on this occasion, of which we know you would have had very good ones so far, another business perspective is that when we looked at this particular budget speech, bearing in mind that the main budget will come in February, we did also stand back and say, well, what road are we on? What is the message that's coming out of this particular speech which is concentrating our mind? And it is, as we said, as I said to you earlier, another stepping stone on the road to the finalization of the higher growth path and trying to build consensus around that in the near future so that we can take the tough decisions that are needed in order to get on that higher growth path. And when we say tough decisions, and I think that the Minister of Finance himself has said that, it means that if it was so easy to grow, then many more countries would be doing a lot better than they are. And in fact, it's probably a score of countries in recent years who've been able to reach the sort of economic performance that is eye-catching and striking, that actually makes a difference to employment and to living standards. So it's not easy. It's a big challenge. But we need to take that challenge on, and we need to accept that there will be tough decisions. And it means that one of the important points you have to decide is how is the pain of getting onto the higher growth rate to be distributed among the different players, whether it's government or business or labor. Those are key decisions that have to be taken so that we can get onto that higher growth path. But like you, Chair, we think that the global situation is actually very favorable for developing countries like South Africa if they seize that initiative. But we also had, if I could put it this way, almost like a sort of vision of where we could be if we could get onto that higher growth path. And let me just then in conclusion share that with you. If we look at the current situation, that South Africa's gross domestic product is $280 billion. That means if you split it over the population of roughly 50 million, that's $5,000 per head. If we were to grow 3%, 3 to 3.5%, in other words, if we took a scenario which was almost what I'd call the minimal, or what BUSA would call the minimal scenario, if we grew at an average of 3% from now on, then the South African economy will double every 21 years, and our per capita will reach about $10,000 by 2035. That's the one option, what I call the low growth scenario. Now, if we could grow at 6%, if we can take all the right decisions and make the right choices that will enable us to get to a 6% growth rate, then the South African economy could double in size every 12 years, and the per capita income would rise to over $10,000 by 2022. And I say this because we must not underestimate the challenge of doing that. I mean, I'm reminded, and I might have shared the story with you before, of the Chinese economist who came to see me a year or two ago, talk about South Africa. Before I could talk to him about it, He said, you know, Professor Parsons, we have a runaway train in China. We're growing at 10-11%. We have problems. What are we going to do? I said, give me that problem. Give me the problem of a 10% growth rate, and I'll manage it. You'll find trying to get 3 up to 6 is a lot more challenging. So I think that just creates the perspective that we face a challenge there. Now, what does this mean in terms of our economy if we can grow at an average of 6% over the next 25 years, say? That means by 2035 we'd have a $1 trillion South African economy. On the job front, I think we'd all agree that the 6% growth rate is not automatically going to generate all the jobs you want. It has to be supported by appropriate policies that will generate, ensuring that you do create the jobs that you want, and given the challenges we face. So I think we as BUSA, and I might just mention that we will be distributing a document which is currently being finalized, which will set out BUSA's view of how we get to a higher, more inclusive job-rich growth path over the next few decades, which will be finalized in the next couple of weeks. And of course, one of the issues that comes through, that growth alone is not the solution. But try getting jobs without growth. You must have some growth with which you can do things. And the important thing is that your growth target must be supported by the appropriate policies that will help you not only to create the jobs, but to improve the productivity upon which those jobs will in the long run in fact depend. And one must be very careful in this whole debate, Chair, and also to the members of the committee, that in the long run, if you look from a globally competitive point of view, it is the productivity of different economies that in the long run will determine what they can do and what they cannot do, both in terms of growth, in terms of employment, and in terms of social dividends. That's a very important message that I think we must not forget, that in our debate about our economic future, we mustn't let productivity be the Cinderella of that debate. It's a very important part of that debate, and we must ensure that it gets its rightful place. So in conclusion, Chair, as I said, I thought we'd make a very brief presentation, just lifting out some of the business perspectives, not only in regard to the so-called mini-budget, but also to our work in progress, which we hope to make available to you in a couple of weeks' time. We think this is a challenge that has been given to South Africa, to the government, to the social partners, to the community, to turn this economic recovery, which we're now experiencing, into a truly sustained upswing, which will get us onto a higher, more inclusive, job-rich growth path. We have an opportunity, despite the uncertainties in the global situation. The tide has turned in favor of the emerging markets. We must do better in the emerging market club than we're doing now. For example, you'll find that in the recent global competitive survey, we dropped from 45 to 54, not because we're necessarily doing worse, but because others are doing better, those with whom we compete. So there's an important wake-up call there, and that needs to be, I think, incorporated, as BUSA sees it, in our growth path for the future. And this is an opportunity that we must take now, and we see the mini-budget as very much one of the important stepping stones in helping us to get an adequate response to the socioeconomic challenges that we face in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. As per our program, we will discuss your presentation together with the next presentation. The coalition, who is the presenter here? People's Budget Coalition. My understanding is that South Sangoko is part of the presentation also, or the presentation captures the views of Sangoko and South African Council of Churches at the same time. You are familiar with this place, familiar faces. Thank you. You're welcome. Let me say, as you are all aware, that this is a very important process, a process that you all contributed in making sure that the views of millions of South Africans should be taken into account when the budgetary processes are in motion, and also conclusions thereof should take into consideration the views of many stakeholders in South Africa. And to that effect, we have a product that has empowered Parliament to exercise its mandate and judiciary responsibilities in terms of making sure that the executive's views on the budget reflect the views of many, many millions of South Africans. And then I thought I should just remind all of us that as much as this is a mini-budget, the views that are going to be presented here will also help to shape the coming budget in February. Thank you very much. Over to you. You'll introduce yourself and the delegation that is here.
Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting us, the People's Budget Coalition, to make a presentation. My name is Vikashini Govinda. I'm from the Kusatu Parliamentary Office, and with me is Pilisa Nkomo from Sangoko, Black Bash Sangoko, Kisa Mullen from SACC, who will be part of the main presenters, and there will be additional comments from Sydney Khara from Nihau, and Woody Aron from NUMSA. As indicated, the coalition is a coalition of fairly broad organizations, federations in fact, KASATU, Sangoko, and SACC. So we represent a fairly broad constituency, and a constituency that's actually representing people on the ground. We will try and understand, obviously, because of time constraints, that we're going to have to constrain our input, but we'd also want to just highlight the fact that the People's Budget Coalition is actually 10 years old. This is actually only the second input that we're making to an MDDP process, which was the first time was in the year 2009, and then we participated in the hearings as well in the February budget of 2010, primarily because we had historically boycotted the process because Parliament was unable to exercise its power to amend the budget, and we felt that in order to participate in the process, public hearings had to have an impact in terms of the process. So we actually commend Parliament on introducing and passing that act. We'd also, I think, at the end of the presentation, want to highlight some concerns or reflect on the implementation of the legislation over the past year as well. I'll just deal with the broad strokes in terms of the macro issues, and then I'll pass it on to Lisa. At the outset, we want to just raise and indicate our concerns with the MTBPS, the overall stance of the MTBPS. It does not reflect the orientation or the kind of the shift that we feel that should be consistent with a developmental approach, an approach that recognizes that we are still very much deeply entrenched in the recession, and we contest that we're actually emerging from the recession. We are concerned that the approach almost seems to suggest not just a shift away from an emphasis, at least in effect, in terms of addressing inequalities and poverty and unemployment, but also it starts to emphasize and prefer different types of, differentiate between different types of capital, specifically financial capital over industrial capital at the expense of growth in terms of local jobs and local employment, and obviously that will come out in terms of the presentation. Specifically on macroeconomic policy, we're concerned that what the MTBPS does is that it starts to preempt the kinds of initiatives or orientation that the yet-to-be-released growth path document is supposed to do. And by preempting it, it will likely undermine the consultation on the growth path document that is supposed to happen at a later stage, because the growth path document is not finalized as yet. And just to also flag at that point, COSATU has also released its own growth path document, which we'd want to use as a basis for engaging with government and with stakeholders in respect of taking that forward. In particular, we want to just raise our concerns about the relaxing of various forms of exchange rate control. And here, just to highlight that historically, when we eventually admitted that we were in a recession, the issue that was highlighted at the time was that if there was any form of protection that was afforded to us at the time, it was the fact that we had had in place certain exchange control mechanisms which had protected us to some extent from the global economic crisis. And yet we are here now looking at introducing mechanisms to remove that. And this is obviously one of them, which is one particular area where, for example, where we've indicated it's preempting the growth path document in terms of the kinds of strategy that we'd expect to intervene in the economy and in the markets. It's also, as we understand, it also reflects the emphasis on the benefits to financial capital over industrial capital, because the implications of lifting exchange rate controls is that it allows capital flight, and it also allows for increased opportunities for currency speculation at the expense of real investment into local industries. The volatility of the currency, and apart from just the value of the rand, the People's Budget Coalition actually wants to call for mechanisms to ensure that our currency remains stable, because that is the way in which ideally, that would be the ideal platform in which to implement an appropriate and developmentally aligned growth path. Also, I think, and this will be dealt with in terms of more detail by the Nihao comrade, we also want to specifically raise concerns in terms of the initiatives to allow for the government employment pension fund to be diversified and invested offshore. And we feel that this is a move that would be anti-development and anti-investment in terms of local local social spending as opposed to foreign markets. We're also looking at the various proposals on relaxing exchange controls. I think we also then need to be weighed against globally increasing calls to introduce a financial transactions tax, and this has been gaining ground amongst a lot of other countries as well. While there are different mechanisms, essentially, and we support the introduction of a financial transactions tax, essentially these two instruments would pull in different directions. One, which would be in terms of relaxation of exchange controls, would actually undermine the stability of the currency. Whereas if we had to introduce the FETT, it would actually promote increased stability, as we believe, in terms of the currency, and which is actually necessary for real job-led growth and for industrial growth. We're also concerned about the increase or the increased emphasis on contractionary, on what is essentially what appears to be a contractionary budget. We see that over the medium term, the deficit spending has declined, which obviously reduces the amount that's available for social spending. We've also picked up in assessment in terms of the deficit for the current year that the initial projections that were announced in February are almost a percent higher than what the real deficit as where we are currently in terms of October figures. It's almost a percent lower than what was initially estimated in February. And this raises concerns as to whether or not, as well, revenue is being underestimated so as to give the impression of a higher deficit. We also want to just draw attention very quickly in relation to the issue of employment, specifically unemployment, and the questions of decent work. On youth employment, I think the coalition is unanimous on this. We feel that it's a priority. Unemployment is a serious crisis in the country, and particularly, obviously, youth workers. And obviously, we support the idea that there needs to be serious interventions, meaningful interventions to address the problem. But we need to ask the question, where do all youth find themselves? Are all youth in this country in the same situation equally? It's very difficult to actually find differentiated in this aggregated statistics that go beyond and disaggregate between 15 to 24. What it suggests when you have statistics that reflect that people, young people between the ages of at least 15 to 18 are unemployed, it suggests that we have serious problems in terms of the orientation of our unemployment policy. If you look at employment statistics and you look at those who not only are employed, but those who have better quality employment and longevity in terms of not being more vulnerable to repeated retrenchments, unemployment, you'll find that they tend to be people who have access to training and skills. So the question is, do we remove youth out of the opportunity, or remove the opportunities for them to actually access the very skills that will allow them to enter the labor market at a different level, or do we plunge them into the labor market at their most vulnerable, and then later create a revolving door when 10 years later they compete for the next round of youth who are more vulnerable and then would have to then give up their jobs as being the elite in the labor market. I think we need to raise serious concerns about the way in which proposals to address youth unemployment are being marketed. In terms of the NTVPS statement, there is a strong emphasis on looking at the introduction of the youth subsidy. And essentially what we would see is that the youth subsidy would be in effect an attempt to introduce a two-tier labor market. Employers would be allowed to pay workers, a certain level of workers, a different rate of pay through the use of the subsidy. We'll then be able to drive down wage rates, would at the same time employ younger, more vulnerable workers who will not have longevity in the labor market, would be displaced from accessing the very skills that they would require, which would require in terms of formal schooling or through access to FET colleges and such like, and render them permanently vulnerable in the labor market. And it doesn't seem to be a proposal that is holistic or that it is visionary in terms of the long-term impact on it. In this particular case, I think we would argue that we would emphasize or highlight or support the proposals from the Department of Higher Education and Training, which looks at addressing the situation of young workers in terms of the FET colleges to ensure that, at the very least, you delay the entry to the labor market up until a point where they acquire the skills that are required in the labor market. Okay, I'll now hand over to Pelisa. Thank you.
Sorry, Pelisa, before you start, I just want to indicate that I'll leave time management amongst yourselves, but indicate that by 12:30 we should start to engage with the board with your presentation and the presentation of Buza. So still have got 30 minutes to share amongst yourselves, but I won't stop you if you eat into somebody else's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Building from my colleague's input earlier, I think it is our view that SA, South Africa is still mired in global financial crisis, and the lenses that we use to actually affirm that point is based on the fact that the cost of living hasn't changed, and the absorption of labor has not improved, but no creation of new jobs, but instead jobs have been lost. I think you would recall that just the day before the MTDPS statement, State South Africa should release a statement that 80,000 jobs in this quarter have been lost. So we met today having this discussion under a cloud of South Africans who are on a continuous basis being trapped into poverty. I also want to raise the issue that, and I said that poor citizens in the last 5 to 8 years have gone through multiple crises. Crisis of fuel, we've had crisis of food, we've had labor crisis, and now we're sitting with a global crisis. And a lot of them had to do with both exogenous and endogenous factors, which they really don't have control over. And the inequality is on the rise. So while we deal with poverty issues, but the inequality is actually a looming crisis, which we need to really look at. It is as well an economic inefficiency to have such an extreme income inequality in South Africa. And perhaps what the committee department needs to ask to the business sector is that what is it that they're doing to ensure or to promote the saving rate in South Africa? Because currently we have a limited number of people who have access to credit who can actually invest in productive assets, which limits actually either the domestic demand, but as well the growth or the expansion of ownership of assets. We also want to raise our concerns with regards to the MTDPS statement that the focus was very much on the monetary policy with limited focus on fiscal policy intervention. And there was no reference, for example, on the area of redistributive strategy and ensuring that you integrate structurally marginalized citizens into the mainstream economy. I think there is an implicit consensus that black economic empowerment is not suitable, or black economic empowerment is not entirely suitable, a model of wealth that actually South Africa has worked. So we're looking for something different. And you're even looking for more something different when the majority of citizens are more vulnerable. And perhaps the transfer of wealth can be one mechanism to cushion poor households and ensure that they are not trapped, nor pushed deeper into poverty. We also want to raise a concern in relation to the silence of the statement on the macroeconomic restructuring. I think we'd accept that South Africa, in terms of industry, is really dominated by monopolistic and oligopolistic markets, where you see a lot of collusion. I think we've seen the recent collusions in the market now, which in fact has a direct implication on the prices, competition, but as well as it suffocates the small-scale processes. So to some extent, actually, there's no space for new entrants or new players in the market to be able to play in the market. We do want to also raise the question and perhaps even ask members of Parliament to ask the Treasury that in the context of deindustrialization in South Africa, which the productive sector have experienced in the last 15 years, and primarily they seem to be a biasness of the Treasury towards financial capital over industrial capital, which sectors of the economy that will be creating jobs? I think we'd like to know, because you have a significant number of majority of citizens in South Africa who are unskilled and semi-skilled. So which sectors are we, and if we encourage movement of capital in the tertiary sector of the economy. We also note the silence of the MTTBC statement on the agrarian reforms, which we think that's a critical strategy. I mean, to be critical reforms, not only to transfer productive assets to poor citizens, but as well as to deal with issues of food security, but as well as to create an opportunity for unskilled labor to be absorbed into that sector. And we would really like a Parliament perhaps to raise that with the committee. We also would like to raise the issue and the concern about there's a silence or there's a lack of alignment between the trade policy, industrial policy, and trade liberalization. Because you'd want to see that emerging in the MTDC policy so that you actually see what government is prioritizing or what developmental agenda that government is pursuing through these three key pillars of policies. And currently we're not seeing the integration of that. And then the other issue is really linked to the issue of increase of tariffs. I mean, I think when we talk about the cost of living of the poor and the fact that a lot of households are still trapped into poverty. So when you increase tariffs, you're not only reducing the situation of income, both at household level but as well as communities, but I think what you're really doing is that you're putting more strain on communities that they end up using their own limited income into consumption instead of either human capital or income generation. So I think, in fact, already there's a problem around access to basic health care. I mean, free access to basic services. For example, people who live in informal settlements do not have access to free to all the free basic services. And if you're increasing tariffs, you're actually increasing the burden. I think lastly, really, the point is linked to, my last point is linked to the Millennium Development Goals. We would have liked to hear a lot more of a developmental language, of course, supported by strong policy commitments. You'd recall last month or September that the government presented a report, and I think one of the key issues they're admitting to have been failing on is certainly MDGs, and we'd like to see integration of that, even though, of course, we would like to assert that MDG is a bare minimum in terms of where South Africa is in terms of resources. It should be seen, we would want to see it as part of integrated developmental or social paradigm in South Africa, because our view is that the current social paradigm has actually left productive communities into consumption communities. So why communities should depend on milk from outside and depend from bread from outside, while actually there could be an investment or financial venture capital to ensure that communities become productive. So we are concerned about the issue of access to developmental finance, which the MTDP statement is silent on, and that could be one of the key vehicles to ensure that there's access to income, but as well as the economic activities that are undertaken at a local level. Thank you, Chair.
Over to you. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. My name is Keith Vermeulen, I'm South African Council of Churches, and I'm the Director of its Public Policy Liaison Unit. I'm grateful for the opportunity, and as the previous speakers have already mentioned, I'm grateful to be part of a process that we've struggled for and have, I want to say fought for, but that's not the right word, basically, but have activated in terms of the Moneyballs Amendment and Related Matters Act that is now giving an opportunity for civil society to participate in the comments on the MTBPS. Unless the Chair is not there, may I proceed, sir? Thank you. Just to iterate, and I'll be very brief, is the Council of Churches has for the past 2 years been in support of and integral sector of the People's Budget campaign, and to bring something of a different slant that the Minister of Finance brought to his speech, where we are in complete agreement with, is that the economy is largely about a moral issue. It's not just about number crunching and the allocations of numbers. The Minister said so himself. It is about people and the quality of lives of people that are affected. And that's the contribution that the Council of Churches has brought to the People's Budget campaign, is to advance a proper budget and spending in terms of spending choices that enhance the eradication of unemployment or the promotion of full employment in support of COSATU, and in terms of the eradication of poverty. But the moral issue has really been for churches, the unethical and immoral conditions of inequality that we face in South Africa. And the rising Gini coefficient, which is now in a dubious leadership leading position in the world, makes nonsense of all kinds of figures, least of all, as we know, even that as we increase the GDP of this country, if the skewed distribution of that GDP is in the proportion of the Gini coefficient that we have, it does not bode well for and has not voted well over the past 16 years for poverty eradication, nor for the eradication of inequality. In fact, it's been the opposite. So I just wanted, on the basis of that ethical position and of the ethical concern, that yes, the economy is about the distribution of quality resources, and particularly the fiscal resources, to the people, and it is government's important task to ensure, in terms of constitutional provisions, access to the constitutional rights of particularly the poor and marginalized. There are three areas I'd like to just raise questions about. The MPVTS statement has made some intimations about the cost-reflected increases by ESCOM, and this raises the question about the ongoing problem still of access to water, for argument's sake, in a water-scarce continent and country. And the question that we would raise within the People's Budget Campaign, and the People's Budget Campaign has been raising, is the free basic provision of water and electricity adequate at this stage? Secondly, in terms of looking at the proposal of dealing with inequity in our country, and particularly around the issues of healthcare, the People's Budget Campaign has, for the past 10 years, been advocating for a national health insurance and for a universal access to healthcare by all, especially the poor, in South Africa. So we welcome the intimations of the introduction of a national health insurance. The People's Budget Campaign, however, has argued basically over the past 10 years that it would make sense to integrate the public spending and the private spending, which 10 years ago was the same amount basically. I think it was roughly about 68 billion spent on 20% of the population, whereas the public sector was spending the same amount for 80% of the population. I understand that right now 78 billion last year has been spent by the private sector on 14% of the population, so that number is decreasing, and the greater proportion in the same month is being covered by the state, including the care for those suffering from HIV/AIDS, which is not being borne in a real sense by the private sector. So we welcome, in terms of a more equitable distribution and access of health, the proposed plan of the NHI. We have two concerns, though. The first relates to the repetitive references to PPPs, seemingly pointing to the NHI becoming an arm of private sector. Our second concern is the reference to the increase in VAT being collected as meeting the shortfall of fiscal requirements for the NHI. Now, we have spoken, and I've heard the oft-repeated concern of VAT being a regressive tax. Our feeling from the People's Budget Campaign would be is that it would be more appropriate to be taxing expenditure on luxury goods as a wealth and health tax, rather than relying on the regressive VAT. But concerns being expressed about that. I think the third concern is that in the absence of a white paper on the national health insurance, we are not having any clarity in terms of nuts and bolts and real figures. We're kind of punching into thin air, and the People's Budget Campaign would appreciate seeing a white paper delivered for greater exploration, participation, and consideration by civil society. Final question. Comment again, in terms of the equality provisions, the Council of Churches has, with the People's Budget Campaign, supported the recommendations of the Taylor Committee of Inquiry, particularly on to the provisions of comprehensive social security package to deal with particularly the inherited and piecemeal social security provisions that have been inherited from apartheid. And we have laid our support for the Taylor Committee recommendations quite clearly in 2002. We are delighted to hear that the Minister is speaking about opening the discussion in terms of the consolidation of those recommendations. We have a concern, though, and we would question issue not addressed has been the recommendation of a universal income by the Taylor Committee. And we firmly believe is that if there is one grant that would deal with the inequality that we face in our country, particularly in terms of the question of unemployed youth that was raised by a colleague from COSATU, then certainly universal income grant would be that particular piece of social security that would ensure that. If there was any concern for unemployment, then we would be looking at the strengthening, certainly, of the comprehensive social security, including the provisions of the basic income grants. That concludes my kind of questions and concerns, but thank you, sir, for the opportunity, and thank you for allowing us to affirm our participation and role in the People's Budget Campaign.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. My name is Arun, and I'm from the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, NUMSA. I here to represent them today. We've been given a slot, and we actually welcome this opportunity, and we thank you for giving us the slot. And we just want to highlight a few points. We don't want to try to avoid repeating what has been said by some of our colleagues here in the PBC. What we want to do is to try and highlight a few points. And this said, I'll start as follows. One, we, and NUMSA welcomes the statement from the minister and the strong stance that he's taken against corruption, rooting out corruption, and the fact that he's put 5 initiatives in place. It's much more decisive than the last, than what he said in the last budget. So the thing about taking a strong stance on corruption and rooting out corruption and fraud, I think this is something that the union welcomes. But we do have some concerns, and recently the General Secretary of NUMSA has made a number of public appearances, and he's been raising concerns, and these are the concerns that he's raised. He's raised concerns over the interest rate. He's raised concerns over the relaxation, further relaxation of exchange controls, and he's raised concerns about the strong exchange rate. I'm not going to speak on all of them because I think some of them have been covered in detail, in much more detail by the PBC. But I just want to share some views with you on this question of the strong exchange rate. Now, recently, the governor of the Reserve Bank said, look, this is a good time to take advantage of the strong rand, and this is probably makes economic sense, but it's a good time to take advantage of the strong rand, and we could use that to actually, you could use that to fund the capital, our capital spending projects. Now, that might sound, that makes for good economic reasoning, but when you purchase, and for those in the know, when you make purchases and you spend the kind of money that is being spoken of here, these are not just short-term purchases where it's not a one-off thing where you just buy a caterpillar or a bulldozer or some earth-moving equipment. These are very, very expensive items. And we don't have the capacity to produce all of it here in South Africa. But the thing is, if we simply say, well, let's just import it and we continue importing these things, then our concern is, how are we going to develop our local industries? And the capacity of our local industries to produce equipment, which we have to rely on imports. And we have to continuously rely on imports. So, The strong exchange rate might help you now to make these purchases, but remember, these contracts, they're not just one-off contracts. They are after sales and servicing. There is the issue of spares. And this is where many overseas companies make the bulk of their revenue. And they're not based on the value of the rand today. These things are always subject to the exchange rate. And if the rand weakens considerably, it might find that we are the receiving end. So we might think we're getting a bargain now, but you're tied up into a contract, and that contract could be like a 10-year contract or a 15-year contract, and you find that it's subject to the exchange rate. And with a very volatile exchange rate, anything can happen. So it's not necessarily that we're getting a bargain now. But the crux and the point is this, is that we need to see that more money is spent developing our local industries.
creating the jobs that we want, creating decent jobs. And we've been saying this now for many, many years. The issue of procurement, this is very important again. I mean, we swing back to this thing. We've been speaking about procurement. The minister speaks about it. But we feel he needs to make a much more stronger statement about procurement. We take into account the issues of beneficiation. And when we look at beneficiation, then we're reminded by some things that Johan Marais once said. And he once said in a paper to delegates attending the South African Sociological Association, it was the 14th Congress at the University of Stellenbosch, he said, beneficiation can only be successful if value is added at every stage of production. And we need to take this seriously into account because we've lost many jobs in the steel industries, in manufacturing, and if we can't link beneficiation to procuring and sourcing locally, we're not going to get to the levels that we want. We're not going to create the kind of 5 million jobs in the new growth path over the next 10 years. So these are important considerations for us. The next issue that we want to say something about is that we've noted again the thing about basic services, electricity, transport, water, and again that servicing the SOE debt is something that eventually is passed on to the consumer. And consumers can't take the burden of this kind of debt. You can't keep passing this debt onto the consumers. The cost of electricity, we're already having a number of problems. Water and transport, that's also included in this now. We've noted, and this kind of differences in approach maybe, in 2009, the Minister, Trevor Manuel, he said in his budget speech, and this is on the lifting of exchange control, he said this, he said, look, we managed to cushion the blow to some extent against the international downturn. And he says part of that, and we were able to do that because of the country's very responsible foreign exchange regulations. 2010, there's a whole list of proposals to further liberalize the exchange controls. And that's not going to help us. We've got to have more engagement on this. Certainly there has to be more engagement on this. The last point is, and we will hold the minister to this, he says, development isn't about numbers, it's about people. And his predecessor said, we will not be deaf to the voice of those in pain. So for us, these are significant statements, but we will hold them to this. We will hold the minister to this. So we want to see jobs being created. We want to see our local industries actually grow. And then maybe we'd be able to get onto the growth path that we've been talking about. Thank you, Chip.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My name is Sidney Caro. I'm from the Nihau Parliamentary Office. I'm just going to make about 3 points very quickly. I'm aware of the time constraints. The first point we want to make is in addition to the point Kosati was making in the presentation about the relaxation of exchange controls. Included in the package of relaxation of exchange controls mentioned by the minister is to allow South African private and public pension funds to invest abroad. We're only now emerging from a context in other parts of the world. In fact, unions in the global north will tell you what has happened to worker savings invested in these portfolios outside. And South Africa is doing, in fact, something which other countries are retreating from. We think that the country actually needs investment. And for us, we need to have investment, we need savings. And to take the worker savings out of the country into outside market is a risk which actually, especially with the GEPF, will have to be borne by the South African government. So, in any event, workers need to be consulted about where their savings are going to be invested. And such a decision is a dramatic statement which caught everybody by surprise, especially because we are at the moment only starting negotiating on what kind of a pension system South Africa requires at NetLeg. And such a policy decision is already taken. And again, it comes back to the point we were making earlier as Kosatu that is preempting the growth path that we are hoping to engage upon going forward. The second point, Chairperson, relates to the statement coming from the MTBPS saying that we need competition in electricity, transport, and communication sectors. These are some of the, there are several statements that the MTBPS makes which are coded, are vague, are unclear, but which I will hope Parliament would have to get clarity from the Minister. Because we are not sure whether here we're talking about privatization, for example, in Transnet, because already in the news we've heard about talk of that. In a parastatal which is unstable at the moment in any event. So it's a point of concern that we can't revert back to the old ways of doing things, such as privatization. And the last point, which is more important for people of the finance, the Standing Committee on Finance, is earlier we referred to our engagement as the people's budget in now into the hearings, given the fact that the legislation has been passed in terms of Section 77 of the Constitution, the money bill legislation. When we look into the implementation of the legislation, we are concerned it doesn't seem as if the necessary instruments, the institutional capacity to support Parliament's oversight work in terms of that provisions of that legislation are provided for. We know that it appears as if there is some work that is happening between the two houses, and one of the reports that we come across suggested that there were expectations that the director of the budget parliamentary budget office was going to be employed by the 10th of by April this year. But when we look at the budget vote for Parliament, it doesn't reflect that in terms of its oversight and legislation program or even on the compensation of employees. So, I mean, if we were outside the process because we didn't think that Parliament had a capacity to exercise its powers, we would be concerned and be participating going forward if the legislation is not implemented. But we're hoping that that will change in due course. Related to that is the fact that now I'm speaking on behalf of NEHAWU as a union in the public service, that in this year's agreement with the PSEBC, there is an understanding and signed by government that the budget won't be used to predetermine the outcome of negotiations as a way of avoiding unnecessary strikes. The MTBP already is talking about 6.3% in the medium term as wage adjustment for public service workers. We think that we are going to have a difficulty next year because, in our view, they are using a very optimistic forecast of inflation. If you were to compare it, for example, with their 4.1% with the reserve banks, and it appears as if the Treasury has already predetermined the negotiations at the PSEBC. So, as now we are concerned about that, we hope that there will be consultation before the budget is finalized for next year. That will be the last point, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you for being a disciplined force in terms of time management, comrades. I don't want to qualify it. I'm saying a disciplined force in terms of the presentation. Honourable members, we have the opportunity to can engage with the presentation. I must also indicate that we know that we have lost one of our honorable members and a comrade, Comrade Alina Ransolase. And there's a memorial service currently taking place up to 1 o'clock. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention so that as we engage with this presentations, we also bear that in mind. Maybe we can get some 10 to 15 minutes to join our colleagues in the memorial service. It's a very sad thing that has happened to ourselves here in Parliament. Honourable members, let me also indicate that the presentation that you have made to us, normally we do get all the 10 submissions. We will then make sure that we go back into those submissions so that we are well informed, given the fact that we do not have enough time to go into the detail with you. Honorable George, Honorable Mutimele, Madlamini, Edwin, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Dr. Parsons, you mentioned several aspects of the MTBPS that you support or BUSA supports. Is there anything that you do not support in the MTBPS? And then to the People's Budget Coalition, on page number 3, you state under 1.5, our view is that MTBPS is the same as the one before the Polokwane Conference. We therefore reject it. That's actually quite it's a very strong statement. And my question to you, is there anything in the MTBPS that you can support? Then on the youth employment, you mentioned that COSATU does not support a youth wage subsidy. Now, my understanding is that the objective was to lower the cost to get inexperienced workers into the job market, where they would then acquire skills and then become more marketable and mobile. Yes, people would move around, but that is how an efficient market would actually operate, to the benefit of the people in the market. Is COSATU not merely protecting its members who are already employed from unwanted competition? And then on the issue about the Parliamentary Budget Office, it is true that the Parliamentary Budget Office is not yet in place. However, it is not correct to assume, which I'm sure you're not doing, that this committee cannot do its work in the absence of the office. We do very good work in the absence of the office, and we fully understand the numbers, etc., that we are looking at. And then finally, it was mentioned that Parliament can amend the budget, but we haven't done so yet. Do you have any views on that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The Chairperson, it is said that there is a huge demand for commodities, and I guess South Africa is also endowed with some of those commodities. And the business is talking about private-public partnership. And this private-public partnership is obviously not about government dishing out jobs for the private sector. It should go to the strategic level, partnership at the strategic level in terms of how to grow the economy. Now, I'm just checking with the business as to whether they do have a strategy in place to make sure that this windfall also creates jobs in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair and the co-chairs. Firstly, maybe one needs to actually thank the presenters for making time to come and do the presentation. We really appreciate and to hear so many concerns. But thanks to those who actually gave concerns together with the solutions as to what needs to be done better to improve the medium-term budget policy statement. To Dr. Root, I do acknowledge that you have also acknowledged the shift or the paradigm shift from the previous MTBPS to the recent one, where you see the alignment between the budget itself, the statement itself, and the new economic growth path. We appreciate that. Much as priorities need to be done, still a lot of work needs to be done. So I appreciate that. But however, maybe what I'm going to ask you now, because of the time frames, you might not have the answers. You might not give me the answers that are going to satisfy my thinking or my perception towards what you have said. So I would suggest that you have proposed that there is a document that you have compiled. And I'm assuming that what I'm going to request, maybe it's going to be within that document. If you can make that document be available to us as the committee so that we try and understand these proposals, because it's quite crucial proposals, because you indicated that within the document there are ways of how to improve the competitiveness, which is very critical. We need to understand that as the committee so that we assist the minister to ensure that really indeed the new economic growth path that has been tabled by the cabinet and approved by it, it becomes effective, efficient, and effectively. And also, you said we need to find future balances of our policies. And you recommend that we need to have tough actions. You see now, those are very critical recommendations. And you have highlighted. Once the policies are not balancing that as a committee, we have got a serious problem. That's why I'm saying maybe those answers are in that book because of the time frames, I might not get them. But I would really appreciate the chairperson that Dr. Root forward those that document if it's completed so that we go through it. To the collision. I don't know, maybe they need to go deeper and maybe explain to us the stabilization of the currency, because my understanding is that the currency, the stabilization of the currency doesn't determine by South Africa alone. It's a global factor. It's a global factor. So what do we need to do? Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, I've got only three questions to PDC. I think I've also noted, like Dr. George, that the early parts of the document are using quite strong language, and that's a little caution that maybe in the future, sneering at one's opponent does not always give the intended result because it diverts focus to resolve issues. So I would appreciate as a person that perhaps in our next engagement we avoid this strong language. But my question is, in terms of your document, you are actually advocating for reduction in the interest rate as one way of creating jobs. I'm interested to know now, to what level should the interest rate be reduced? And when at that level, how will it help the country to create what types of jobs? And perhaps you might have some research as to how will the levels of unemployment be reduced if the interest rates are at the level that you are suggesting. Question number two, on the tax speculative capital inflows, you are actually calling for tax on the capital inflows. And you are also saying that will also assist in terms of this whole issues of unemployment and stuff like that. But earlier on, as you have heard during the first two presentations, there's been some research in terms of what is happening in Brazil and others, Brazil, Thailand, and all those other countries, where what you are proposing was done and it yielded no results as expected. What are your views on that? I mean, what you are proposing in the context of what is now happening in Thailand and Brazil specifically, compared to our economy, how will that bring change? And lastly, in terms of the point that you're making around the pension funds,
vis-à-vis what the minister says during the presentation of the MTBPN. I would like you to expand a little bit so that some of us understand exactly what is the bone of contention here, because as a former trustee, I know for a fact that some of the monies, the pension fund monies of employees, whether invested in the markets or in socially derived desirable investments, some of those monies find its way out of the country. Now, is it a question of the percentage that should go out, or are you totally against that? And what exactly is your view? If you can just become more clear. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, honorable members. Professor Parsons, you'll be the first to respond before the coalition take their questions. But for your sins, you'll also respond as Dr. Root. I don't know why.
Sorry, Chair. I'm very sorry to profess. I'm so sorry.
So, but for your sins, you'll respond as Dr. Root.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
I'll just ask one of my colleagues to start with the first question. I'll deal with the others.
I'm going to respond to the question by Honorable George on what don't we agree with. Bruce's view is that broadly the mini-budget statement is appropriate given the current economic climate. However, when you disaggregate some of the elements, we do have some concerns. For example, on issues of administered prices, we're very much worried about the role of tariffs on competitiveness. Secondly, if you look at the intimation by the minister that over time there might be need for additional taxes, we are monitoring that space. However, we've always believed that the fiscal policy framework is not really the problem in South Africa. The problem has been on implementation of that framework. It's been on the outcomes from the allocations on the budget. That's always been the business approach. So then the reason we're very supportive of this statement is because we realize that there's greater focus on efficiencies from government spending. For example, the initiatives to address corruption in government are very important. 21 billion rand has already been uncovered in fraud is a significant amount. So indeed, we are very much supportive. There are other areas which we will discuss with Parliament and the National Treasury, which we want to deal with at a later stage. Thank you.
Chair, the two other questions which I will briefly address. The first is, I think the one question dealt with, I think I heard a question about commodities. I'm not quite sure what that meant, the global commodity upturn. But I think what we need to do here is perhaps just to divide my response into two parts. First is, it's clear from the minister's speech, and I think our own experience was that even with the previous upturn in the global cycle of commodity prices, we did not maximize the gains because we were not sufficiently competitive. So this time round, we're already seeing signs of the next commodity boom. We're certainly hoping that we will be positioned, particularly if we get on with the infrastructural investment that we're committed to, that we will be able to capitalize on it. But in relation more specifically to the role of public-private sector partnerships, I think our view as BUSA has been that once again, under the current arrangements, something between 3 and 5% of total infrastructural spending is committed to public-private sector partnerships. By global standards, this is something of a tenth of what other very competitive economies are able to mobilize in terms of public-private sector partnerships. So one of the things we will endeavor to do in our document, which will be coming and to which reference has been made, is to say, to unpack, well, yes, it's fine to say that. There's the rhetoric of public-private sector partnerships, but what have been the problems? There are some practical problems on both government and the private sector, the management of risk, etc., but we must take the attitude that we wish to solve those problems, see how we can make better use of that mechanism to get more outcomes and to get them far sooner. The other point, which I think is related to that, was in relation to the issue of competitiveness and productivity, which I did refer to, and which I hope will also be embedded in our document, which, by the way, is called towards a higher, more inclusive, job-rich growth path. So those elements will be unpacked. Clearly, as I said, productivity in the long run is where many good things must come from. I would perhaps just leave you with the thought that given the unusual times in which we live and the unusual challenges we're facing and the adequate responses which we all want to develop towards getting to a higher growth path, that Chair, your committee may want to consider a presentation from Productivity South Africa. They are the instrument, the statutory instrument, who are there to promote productivity. And they've done a lot of work, and as I said in my earlier comments, I think there's a slight risk that productivity is going to be the Cinderella of this debate. And I think that perhaps some input from them to your committee might indeed be quite helpful. And then finally, Chair, I think that we will also, in our document, revisit the issue of exchange rate stability, not as a matter of postponing the decisions, because, in fact, as I indicated, we support the steps that have been outlined in the budget for the reasons that both the Minister and ourselves have outlined. I would simply make the point that if the exchange rate was falling by as much as it's been rising, there would have been cries going up that we must do something about it. But for some people, when you're moving into overvalued territory, suddenly they want to be Pontius Pilate and say there's nothing you can do. What we can do is limited. But what we can do, we should do. And we mustn't think it's only once you've exhausted the conventional instruments that you must then perhaps think whether you have to do anything else, whether you can afford to do anything else. And there we must learn from the experience of other countries who thought they could go an unconventional route, but it didn't deliver the outcome. So I think we accept that probably the furthest you can go is what the Minister said in his main budget speech, which is you can lean against the wind. You can develop some instruments which will help you, but you're up against a global situation which is often more powerful than what you can do domestically, and hence we think we should really throw our weight behind all efforts by South Africa and its allies to come out of the Korea conference with some better management of the exchange rate tensions that exist. And finally, Chair, to say that we hope, and in the spirit of what you said earlier, we try to say that although one was approaching the sort of reaction to the budget statement as if, well, this is November and it's another budget statement, we ourselves have interpreted it against a much bigger picture. It's an important stepping stone, not only to the next budget, but to this growth path that we want. And we're hoping that the document to which reference will be made and which is in the process of finalization will, of course, be made available to this committee as soon as it's finalized. And we hope to do that in the next couple of weeks, because we wish, as business, to enrich the debate that is now unfolding about the growth path. Our only sort of caveat would be that we want to also make a contribution to that debate, and this document will be, we hope, an important discussion document from the business community, which will indeed add to that debate, and we will certainly make it available to this committee. So thank you, Chair.
Thanks. I will take the first two questions and then the others will respond to that. On the issue of what do we support in the budget, I just want to indicate, yes, while we use the word reject, it's very strong. It's within the context of that the key fundamental issues in terms of what to turn around the economy, where we really have fundamental disagreements. There were areas that we do support, but they were not the areas where we would focus on in terms of where we find ourselves currently in the current economic climate. And the two particular areas that I would want to highlight at this stage, and I think they're not trivial. The first is the emphasis on addressing and eradicating corruption, because what has been identified are very meaningful and we hope for transparent steps to address that. And the second was in relation to the question of increased regulation and supervision of the banking sector. Our one concern, though, was that obviously that was being contradicted by relaxation of the exchange controls. But as you can see, those are not the big ticket items in terms of the, addressing the current economic situation we find ourselves in. On the question of youth employment, and here I'm going to answer this not so much as part of People's Budget Campaign Coalition, but as the Federation of Kusatu, because I think the question was directed at Kusatu specifically. And I think it's quite relevant that the question is asked as to whether or not we're taking our membership from unwanted competition. Now, we won't speak about on behalf of membership of other federations. We won't speak on behalf of the youth represented from other past families or even youth who are descendants of members of parliament, but we speak on behalf of our membership. If you look at them statistically, and you look at our membership and you look at their earnings, they come from very low-income households. In fact, often extended households. And if you expand your investigation into those households, you will find that very often our membership are supporting unemployed people of all ages, including the youth. So youth employment is very close to our concerns. But I think one thing that Kusatu membership and working class people have in common with at least middle class and above is that they have ambitions for their children as well. And that is that they would not want their children to enter the labor market to be simply exploited by capital. And if you enter them in the labor market when before they've had a chance to acquire the relevant form of skills, then that's what you're going to do. With working class children, by implementing youth subsidy, what we're essentially doing is forcing poor people to make a choice and to surrender access or surrender the fight for formal qualifications. If, and we've referred to the lack of access or the lack of information on disaggregation of youth statistics. If you look at the labor market, the labor force survey, you'll find the statistics reflect youth employment from 15 to 24. Now, we all don't have to do any scientific assessment to unpack that, but between the ages of 15 to 24, and with someone who has had opportunities in their life, there are various stages. The first stage would be completion of school. The next stage, and this is typical of any middle-class family, is to find them into some kind of formal training and acquisition of skills, whether it's a university or some other form of tertiary institution. At no stage does any parent from that kind of background want their child to enter the labor market, and not for an emotional reason, but for a rational, long-term reason as to how you address and promote that youth access to the labor market, the level at which they enter the labor market, the longevity in the labor market. In the same way as you plan for the economy, for the children of this country, that's the approach we've got to adopt. It's not an emotional response. It's a rational response. And that is why we're supporting the proposal in relation to from the Department of Higher Education. And also, just on the question of unwanted competition, and I think we should look at the examples from how the learnerships have panned out. I mean, look at particularly the examples of the banking sector. They've used it as a free exploitative supply. Learners who have been taken on have to go through a revolving door. Instead of using those learnerships and moving those learners into other positions in the banking sector as skilled workers, they promptly ejected out into the labor market, and then the next round of recruits come in. So essentially, all we have to do is look at the practical dynamics and apply a bit of logic, and we understand that the youth subsidy is really about creating a two-tier labor market and rendering particularly black and especially African youth found in the labor market and creating an increasing pool of exploitative labor, something that no one would support.
Okay. I'll take the question on the exchange rate stability. Yes, you're absolutely right. There are exogenous factors that affect the stability of the exchange rate. But however, there are endogenous instruments that any national government needs to put in place. Now, you don't take one form of stabilizer and say it should yield good results. You have a package of stabilizers that you need to apply to ensure that you limit and you protect the exchange rate volatility and the movement in the market. Amongst those is the interest rates. The second one is the regulation of the capital inflows. And the third one is imposing a tax on transactions. I mean, for example, one example in South Africa is that the high interest rates attracts more financial markets, which it means that you have more capital inflow, but that only moves into the capital in the tertiary sector of financial markets, but it doesn't move to the progressive sectors. So South Africa has not really exhausted its package of policies and the coherency. In fact, for example, I think the question about countries that have actually ensured that they institute instruments domestically to actually stabilize their markets have higher projection goals. For example, South Korea is expecting 4.6% of growth. Now, in any economy, you don't create jobs if you grow less below 4%. South Africa is projected to grow between 3% and 3.6%. So it means that there are no jobs that will be created. You are again going to be sitting with capital flowing in the financial markets. I mean, the second issue is that, for example, Brazil has imposed taxes on speculative capital to ensure that they insulate their own economy. Korea has also restricted movement of capital. They are considering now to impose taxes on future and futuristic investment and they are calling for global safety nets as a mechanism to insulate their own economies. So actually, once you then loosen up your exchange control, you make your economy even much more vulnerable. And that's the stance that South Africa is taking.
Chairperson, there was a question about the Money Bills Amendment and Related Matters Act. Yes, I mean, you should not be misunderstood. We are not suggesting Parliament at the moment is unable to effect any changes if it seeks to do so. Far from that. We are simply saying legislation provides for certain institutional capacities to be built in Parliament. In other words, the mandate Parliament has imposed upon itself, so it needs to be executed so that in future, when it's necessary, Parliament will be able to do so. And when it's not provided for in the budget of Parliament, it's an issue which a formation like a proposed budget will be concerned about. We do indeed hope in the future there will be a possibility where Parliament really enforces the executive to align spending to priorities, which, as you heard in our submission, there is some misalignment in some areas. Not entirely in every area, but there is that. The second question was on the issue of allowing pension funds to go and invest abroad. Yes, there is some already form of relegation as we speak. But the reality is South Africa is not as open as openly exposed as it was as it is in many parts of the world, especially in Latin America, where they followed the same model of the World Bank of moving away from defined benefit pension funds. We were poised to engage not only to talk about a national retirement insurance reform scheme, which will define what type of retirement as part of social security system we envisage for the country, and that will also inform where pension funds can be invested in the country, or what priority sectors can be supported using the country savings. We are already making decisions for the savings that we need to be allowed to go abroad. That's an issue of concern. That's the basis of our concern. But the second issue related to that is the fact that in every country where you're dealing with social security, it's normally a tripartite process, because workers make contribution, employers make contribution, and also the state make a contribution. And you need to have a proper consultation for such decisions, which which I think the MTBPS makes a preemptive before a proper consultation can take place. It's unheard of, for example, in Europe for such a stance to be taken.
Thank you to the presenters, to the questions and to the inputs that was made. Co-chair, yes. When we leave this room and tomorrow we go on with the deliberations and getting views from stakeholders, but when we get to our constituencies and face our people, the point is we must give them hope. This is part of the giving hope. To get your views to take South Africa forward. With these last words, Olwachani, I see your hand.
There's just that question on the interest rate, it's not been answered.
Interest rates, too.
Or maybe it's fine, we can, because of time, we'll leave it in the next engagement. It's okay. Now, as we walk out,
yeah.
Just meet with them.
It's another practical way to get the answer. Do it in walking. Honourable members, thank you. That brings us to the end of this meeting.